Spider-Man does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes a Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud. He's got radioactive blood. Can he swing from a thread? Take a look overhead. Hey there goes a Spider-Man.
Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff. This week on the show, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse has swung into theaters and into our hearts. Jonathan has been playing more Super Smash Bros. Ultimate, and we're going to talk to you about our plans for the end of the year as we reach Christmas and New Year's and all that. But yeah, how are you feeling, Sean?
I feel pretty good. I'm now, as of like, I think yesterday, I'm on my break.
Nice.
For this little period before I do student teaching. And so I haven't had a lot of time to do other things, which is why I'm glad that we are able to talk about Spider-Man.
Yes.
But yeah, it has been busy, and now I'm just like slowly transitioning into my little break period before it's all over.
I threaded the needle so hard on the end of my semester in terms of getting everything in on time. And like, you know, my last paper was like, I got it in Thursday night, Friday being the absolute last deadline. I just finished grading all of my papers this afternoon and got that all done. And I am now done. I am free for a month. I'm driving out starting tomorrow, Sean. So I'll see you in a couple days. And I'm coming back out to Colorado. But yeah, we're recording this. This will probably be a shorter episode than we normally do because our only big topic is Spider-Man. There's been nothing really in the entertainment news to talk about, the kind of silly news that we do. No brand new game launches, although I'm sure you and I are both still working through the just endless orgy of video games that arrived at the end of this year. I know I am.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit more about Smash Bros. I'm interested to hear if you have anything else. But before anything else, before we get into some housekeeping stuff here, Sean?
I don't think so.
All right. I've got a couple pieces of housekeeping. One is that I made a film. This is one of the things I did this semester. I was in a production class at the University of Colorado, where I got my bachelor's and my master's. We didn't really cross over and do production classes if we were film studies people, so I didn't make a lot there. In fact, all the movies I made while at Colorado were not for film classes, which was a weird thing. But I did for this. I was in a production class. It was really cool. Got to work with some of the MFAs, who are always awesome people. And I made a film. It's called Foundations. It is online now. It's on YouTube. It's also on JonathanLack.com if you want to go find it really quickly. It is an experimental short film. It's about 18 minutes long. You'll hear my voice in it, the voices of some of my friends who agreed to act in the project, and original music by my brother Thomas Lack, who is a very, very talented composer and really tied the entire thing together for me. So that was really nice. And it turned out well. It was fun to shoot. I shot it all over the state of Iowa this year. And yeah, it's out there. You can watch it. It's kind of pretentious, but you know, that's what student films are for, and I had fun.
Yep. Awesome.
Yeah. So that is out there. So you know, if you want to see me actually making something rather than criticizing other people's shit, you can watch that. It's a new experience. Let's see. Sean, let's fill the listeners in on what we've got planned for the end of the year, because things can get weird.
Yes. And yeah, because as you said, you're coming into Colorado tomorrow.
Which is, so, well, by the time they hear this, I'm already in Colorado. Because we're recording this Saturday night. This will be the Monday, the 17th episode, is what you're listening to right now. And we're going to have episodes the next two Mondays. Like, that's the weird thing, is we're not breaking the timeline here at all. So we have a week from today, when you're listening to this, is December 24th, which is Christmas Eve for those of us who celebrate it. And for the rest of us, you still get the day off, so that's pretty nice. One benefit of, you know, Christian dominance over the government is we do get a couple holidays out of it. Otherwise, I'm not sure there's much of a benefit. But there you go. But yes, and on December 24th, Sean, I'm keeping it a surprise, but I have a plan. We're going to do a very silly, fun episode. At least one topic. We'll talk about other stuff as well that's more topical. But I have a Christmas-themed thing we're going to review, and it's going to be a blast.
I'm excited, because it is so a secret that you have not actually told me what it is yet.
I know.
You just told me there's a secret thing we're going to do.
It very much relies on you will be reacting to it in real time on the show.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so I'm looking forward to that then.
So we'll record that in the next couple of days. That'll be pre-recorded a little bit. and we're going to do that. And then December 31st, the last day of the year, happens to fall on a Monday, which is when we release episodes. So the last episode of the year will be on December 31st. It'll be on New Year's Eve, and that'll be our end of the year show where we review our, or we do our top 10 games of the year and do all of our awards and honorable mentions and other things. And I am very happy, Sean, that it shook out this way and we have the entire month of December to get this together, because my list ain't ready yet.
Yeah, neither is mine. No, so
I'm really, now that like I'm done with school, that is like the project the next 2 weeks for me, is to finish playing things. I have a couple of games on my docket that are like indie games that should only take like a day to do, but I haven't gotten to yet. I like to write up notes for all of these. I want to go replay stuff. And this has been a crazy year. I don't know about you, but my short list has 16 games on it.
Yeah, no, I was looking at it the other day, and it's too much. And like with you, there's a couple that I know I'll be able to put in between now and then, and it's bad.
I know. So we'll get there, but that'll be 2 weeks from now. So yeah, and then we're going to have a couple of pre-recorded episodes after that that we're going to knock out while you and I are together in Colorado, and those will get us through maybe the beginning of January while you and I are getting back into the swing of, you know, adult life. But we will make sure you guys have a show, and yeah, it should be fun. And finally, to help kick us into the new year, we still need to do voting on our next podcast movie retrospective series, Sean. So I thought you and I would revisit. We have not gotten any suggestions, so this, it seems like people are happy with the choices we made. So let's narrow this down to 4, Sean, from the choices I have, and then I will put this out as a poll later this week. So follow me on Twitter, at Jonathan Lack. Very easy to find. You can also, jonathanlack.com, my Twitter is right there on the right-hand side of the page, and you can vote in this poll. I'll retweet it a couple times, and we'll leave it going for a couple of days. But Sean, we had the Dark Knight trilogy, the Lord of the Rings trilogy, Sergio Leone's Dollars trilogy, Harry Potter movies, ... original Muppets trilogy, all 26 Zatoichi movies, ... or fewer. That is 6 items. What 2 would you cut?
I think it's a very easy choice for me, Harry Potter and Muppets Ghost.
Okay. Maybe we'll come back to those, but we'll take those off for now. I also had on the list Evangelion. We talked about maybe doing that when it comes out on Netflix, but it's not out on Netflix yet, so it gets cut. All right. So I will put these up, and people can vote between Batman, Lord of the Rings, Sergio Leone, and all 26 Zatoichi movies or fewer.
Yes.
Yes. Probably not all 26.
You know, it all depends on you, Jonathan. If Zatoichi gets voted, I am fine with doing rewatching all the Zatoichi movies.
This becomes the weekly Zatoichi podcast.
You know, I've been waiting for it.
We get
that'll last us half a fucking year.
We get a partnership with Criterion and just get it going. Yeah, all right. Anyway, we will look into that. I will put that up as a poll, but we will be choosing between those. And finally, why don't we end this section with a couple of listener questions, Sean?
All right, awesome.
All right, so listener questions. We have 2 this week that have come in so far. I'll check again by the end of the show if anything else has come. But we have from J.M. Baxter asks, any more thoughts on the localizations of Persona 3 and Persona 5 Dancing? I can't stop playing either of them. Well, we certainly understand that sentiment. When they were out in Japanese, I know you and I both had the same, these are hard to stop playing.
Yes, I mean, we both platinumed to both of those games.
Yes, and I didn't even understand all the language. You did. But let's see. So I have not played any more of these this week because I've been very busy and Smash Brothers just will not let go of me, which is awesome. But I have not played more of these. I did, however, ask my brother, who has been playing them obsessively and currently has number 1 on the leaderboards in most of the songs in all of Persona 3. He has now moved on to Persona 5. And let's see. We have a couple of thoughts from him. My brother said, he thought that the dual audio was nice to have, although the dub is very good. DLC pricing is relatively reasonable, except for Persona 4 Dancing, where you have to rebuy everything if you owned the Vita version, but we mentioned that last week. He also says, and this is actually interesting because you and I talked about this, Sean, when these were out in Japan. He says, I wish people in America would stop saying they didn't put effort into these two games. Obviously, they were a little more rushed than Persona 4 Dancing, but the dances and choreography are obviously of very high quality, and the remixes are good. And that's something you and I said during the Japanese release.
Yeah, it's clearly each release on its own is lighter in quality, and mostly in like quantity of content, than the Persona 4 Dancing game was. And so I can understand people being a little bit disappointed for that aspect of it, but it is while it has some fewer remixes and it obviously doesn't have the huge, ridiculous, massive visual novel mode and all that kind of stuff, they are still, there's still a lot of game in there. And
oh, yeah.
And honestly, like, I think at the end of the day, I kind of enjoyed the Commu events more than I did the full visual novel story, which had cool bits. You know, Nanako is amazing, and her side of that visual novel in Persona 4 Dancing is incredible, but there's a lot of stuff you need to move through for that, whereas the Commu events are, like, really nicely tied into the loop of that game in a way that worked better.
I agree, and I think, and I'm, that's why I'm excited to dive into them a little more when, now that I am decompressing and have time and when I'm back home, and I can play some of those and watch some of those fun scenes. But I agree about that. So, finally though, Sean, Thomas sent me an email just now. I haven't read it yet. But I asked him to rank the hardest songs in the game now that he has gotten literally perfect scores on All Night on all of them, because he's a crazy person. And by perfect score, I mean you get a perfect on every single note.
Yes.
He cannot get a good or a great. He has to get a perfect. So, and he's a crazy person. And he ranked the hardest songs for us. He said the hardest is Jaldabaoth, however you say that, the R beginning version from Persona 5 Dancing.
Okay, that checks out.
Number two, Burn My Dread from Persona 3 Dancing. That's, the I think, the version that's the group dance.
Yes.
Number three, One Night Break. That's the Persona 5 Dancing one. Not difficult to get through, he says, but I guess to perfect, it's very syncopated. That's the end theme from Persona 5 Dancing. Number four, he said, Reach Out to the Truth, Dancing on the Persona Stage. That's from Persona 4. I guess he ranked all three games for us.
Okay.
He says it's because the rhythm changes frequently. Number five, Rivers in the Desert, the Persona Super Live P-Sound Bomb 2017 edition from Persona 5. Number six, Wake Up, Get Out There, Jazztronic Remix from Persona 5. Number seven, Like a Dream Come True from Persona 4. Difficult because the song is swung, but rhythm chart has to be played straight. Number eight, Time Atlas Kitajo Remix. Persona 3 Dancing, not difficult to get through, but very syncopated and difficult to get a perfect on. Number nine, Mass Destruction Tetsuya Kobayashi Remix, Persona 3 Dancing. He thinks it's more annoying than it is difficult. That's the one that I think is really fast in Persona 3, right?
Yeah, that's also the one that, like, their version of this is a remix of that song is we just put, like, this one guitar lick and this one drum, like, beat over the whole fucking song, and it just goes and goes and goes. I am 100% with Thomas on that one.
Number 10, Now I Know, Yu Miyake Remix from Persona 4. He says it's only difficult because the rhythm chart is programmed poorly. Held notes don't end exactly on beats as you'd expect.
Okay, that's very specific.
Man, you know, I was watching a video early today on Smash Bros. About someone analyzing the changes to Link in this game, and they were getting into, like, the frame count difficulties and stuff. I've never gotten that deep into a video game ever, probably. Thomas is in that territory with Persona, the dancing games. He can tell you all about this shit. Also, Thomas sent us a statement that I guess I'm just going to read raw. I don't know quite what it says, but he had a complaint about something I said to him on the podcast recently.
Oh, okay.
Okay, he says, As an avid listener of the podcast, I wish to rectify some misinformation you spread about me on the program a few weeks ago. While I admit it is ridiculous to pay for DLC twice, the only DLC I actually repurchased was the Persona 4 Dancing All Night DLC, which amounted to roughly $30. Again, I admit that paying for these songs twice may be foolish, but I believe mocking me for paying extra for some of my favorite games is unfair. You suggested I deal drugs to pay for this on the same podcast that you boasted about paying $15 for background music and paying $40 to import short Dragon Ball movies that, frankly, aren't all that good. If you import all the films, that will be roughly $250 spent on films you've already bought at least once. Thomas, I've bought these like three times. I made no judgments, yet you insist on mocking me for my hobbies, so as an avid listener, I ask only for an apology.
Well, Jonathan, what do you have to say for yourself?
I apologize, Thomas, and I thank you for what is easily the greatest listener note we've ever gotten on the show.
Yeah, I apologize on behalf of the podcast, Thomas, and I want to thank you on behalf of the podcast for that massive fucking Jonathan Byrne you just delivered. It was spectacular.
It was pretty good. I deserved it.
Yeah, you did.
Okay.
It's a very good point about your Dragon Ball buying habits.
Oh, yeah. It's a problem. Totally. Yeah. I was actually looking into how much I could get for selling plasma last week for something. Because I ride the bus every day and there's a thing on the bus that says, do you want to sell plasma? We will pay you. So it wasn't out of the blue. But I did, and I put the phone down thinking, Jonathan, this is the stupidest thing you've ever done. So
because were you specifically, when you saw that, was the first thing you thought of was, oh, I can buy those Dragon Ball Blu-rays.
Yeah, it was,
if
Sean.
I sell my blood.
It was, yeah.
Fucking hell, dude. I just, there's something, you know, there's something wrong.
I know.
With, like, the Lack family going on with, like, you shouldn't buy the DLC twice. You shouldn't sell your blood to buy fucking Dragon Ball Blu-rays. It's not that important. Don't do it.
I didn't actually do it, but I will say, I joked about Thomas dealing drugs. He has obviously never done that. I think I came closer to the weird extreme thing than he did. So
yes. Yeah. So at the end of the day, $30 of DLC, it's dumb to buy it again. People shouldn't do that. But it's only $30.
Yeah. And, you know, he didn't decide that he had to buy it again. It was, you know, dumb corporate decision.
Yes, well, I'm saying that even if the dumb corporate decision is made, don't fucking buy the DLC again. Just don't.
All right. Well, anyway, second listener question. That first one took longer than I thought it would. Anthony on Twitter asked, are you interested in getting any of the big game releases in January, like the Tales of Vesperia remaster, Kingdom Hearts 3, and the Resident Evil 2 remake? And I say to Anthony, why are you trying to give me a heart attack? Why are you trying to make me... I'm trying to get through the end of the year. You're making me think about how it starts all over again in 2 weeks, and there's no down period. Remember when there used to be down periods, Sean, where we would go like 4 months without games, and I would like... replay Metroid Prime or be like, I've never played Castlevania, let's play some Castlevania. There's none of that anymore. It sucks.
Yeah, because it used to be that you know, you had a holiday and it was like fucking crazy at the end of November. Unless Nintendo had a big thing coming out, nothing came out in December, nothing came out in January, nothing came out in February. Like, EA and Ubisoft would shit out something, like a bunch of stuff at the end of March, at the end of their fucking fiscal year, and then you'd have nothing until fall. It was like, oh my god, look at all this time I have to play video games. Now, it is, we're just perpetually buried under video game releases, and it is frightening.
But, to be serious about Anthony's question, I mean, it is a good question. I'm not sure. Kingdom Hearts 3 is the one I'm almost certainly going to play, because I'm so fascinated in it, and I think it will be grade A podcast content, especially if I do my plan of not learning anything about the franchise before playing it. I'd love to play that Resident Evil 2 remake. It looks great. I'm not sure if I'll have time, but it looks fantastic.
Yeah, of those, Resident Evil 2 is the one that I'm most likely to pick up. I have not made any specific decisions on any of those games, because none of them are must-plays for me. In Kingdom Hearts 3, I think we floated the idea of what if I played the Japanese version of that game, which that's still a possibility.
That could be fun.
But I'm certainly not committed to that.
We have
definitely
to,
not at the beginning of student teaching. I'm not committing to anything.
No, it's all good. We have to figure out also if Kingdom Hearts 3 is going to have dual audio, which I do not believe has been confirmed. So
yes.
It would be awesome if it did have that. And most Japanese games have that now. Kingdom Hearts 3 is in a weird case where there's all this licensing with the Disney characters, and then you get Japanese voice actors who sometimes have their own licensing deals, especially when it's tied to movies and products like that. So we shall see. But yes, that's probably the one. Tales of Vesperia remaster. Sounds cool. I'm not super into that series, and I definitely don't have time for a JRPG like that at this time. Although one day I'd love to play a Tales game.
Yeah, it's always a franchise I've been interested in from the outside. So I would like to play it at some point. But as we said, there's no down period. So we don't have the period where I can be just like, fuck it, I'm just going to play Dragon Quest 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Like, that just doesn't happen.
I know. It's too bad. It's too bad. All right, Sean, you want to do some stuff? What have you been up to? Anything before we... Now we're just clearing the deck before we talk about Spider-Man.
Yeah. So I've still been playing Hitman 2. I'm almost done with the America level, whatever the neighborhood is. I have not quite moved on to the last level yet. Because I spent more time in Mumbai than I was expecting to, because I really like that map. It is one that I wasn't super into at first, but the more I played it, the more it grew on me. And I think it's particularly once I realized just how much shit you can change in that map when you get involved with like the Kashmirian stuff, and that there's... So the whole setup for the Mumbai map is you have three targets, one of whom you don't know their identity, and there are a bunch of different ways that you can sort of figure out their identity and kill them. And all of the targets are like kind of interrelated because they think they're part of like the same pirate gang or something in the past. And so the two targets whose names you know have hired the same assassin to kill each other, and this assassin is trying to play that situation so that he can kill both those targets and then meet the third target, who's actually like the maelstrom or whatever, who controls this whole area so that he gets in on that guy's good side. And so that's like this whole setup. And if you find the Kashmirian in the level and you access his information, you can then impersonate him in different ways, which moves the targets and causes them to meet with different characters and stuff like that. And that whole aspect of the map I find utterly fascinating. It's got the most interesting narrative content of any Hitman map, like within the map itself, that I've seen, because I just love the interplay between these three strange figures, one of whom is like a corrupt Bollywood actor, one of whom is the slum queen who's just like sort of set up in this whole sort of like the slum neighborhood area and is using her power and influence to manipulate and control people. And then you have the maelstrom, who's this like dark, you know, pirate figure that is in the background, who is operating this whole fucking gang that is patrolling the streets. That whole setup, while like kind of annoying at first because it makes the map a little bit difficult to move around and you have to, you know, get your head around what are the different ways that I can expose the maelstrom's identity. Once you get used to how to do the map, like, I just find the Mumbai map is so full of really crazy possibilities. So I played that map actually like well past I got level 20 mastery, just to see what other weird shit I could do in it.
Nice. I'm still not super into that map. I'm still in that phase you were at earlier on with the map, where it's like, to me, it's like it's so big and daunting. I'm not always sure what to do with it. My favorite two things I've done in that one are the assassination that involves a giant stage fan,
mm-hmm.
and blowing them off the roof. That one's fucking great. And then I did half of the Kashmirian thing. I didn't realize until I was looking at challenges like last week. I haven't played Hitman 2 since our last podcast, but at some point I was looking at the challenges and I realized, oh, the Kashmirian dude, he's trying to assassinate two of them? And I'm like, I gotta get in on this and try to figure that out. Because I only set it up for one of them, and I guess I just missed whatever else was going on. But yeah, it's at the very least, it's one of the most technically ambitious maps they've ever done.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to look at. I do love all the Bollywood parody stuff. That was fun.
Yeah, that stuff's really good. The other thing I have been doing is I have started rereading the Dragon Ball manga.
Yes.
Because we've been getting deep into the Dragon Ball on this podcast again. And I don't think we'd never really talked about it on the podcast when it was happening. Jonathan has just shown me one of his like 50 copies of the fucking manga he's got.
Yes. This is right next to me, Sean, is my bookshelf where I've got the entire English run. And I can't reach them because they're on the bottom shelf, but the run that you're about to talk about, which is the oversized magazine versions.
Yeah, so we probably like mentioned it, but never really got into it on the podcast a couple of years ago. They released in Japan these, I think they're called like the Legends versions, mm-hmm. that they are basically reprints of the Dragon Ball manga in Japanese, but it's in the original Shonen Jump format. So it's the same size, the same materials. It's even got like the Shonen Jump like pirate logo and stuff on the edges and stuff like that. And a lot of like the, like, you don't, it's not like a full reprinting of how they would have been in the magazine to like the most specific details, but it's got a lot of those like ancillary details, and kind of the paratext is there in some form, which is really cool. If you know, go back to my whole discussion about Spider-Man comic books and the best way to read them, you'll know how much I like that shit.
It's also got the original color and stuff, which you know, a lot of it is two-tone color. It's not like full color, but that's there. And you can see like in the original Tonkoban, the graphic novels, and this is like this in Japanese as well, they just would grayscale it, you know? Mm-hmm. So you get all of that. And yeah, the manga had never been reprinted in its original Shonen Jump size, which is so cool because it's part of the experience. He was drawing it to be seen at that size, not at this little digest size.
Yeah, and so it's a really awesome way to read it. Obviously, they were only released in Japan, and so I imported them in Japanese, and then this is like two or three years ago. So it was one of the first big things I did of reading something entirely in Japanese, and so now I'm rereading them through again. And it's nice now because I don't have to wait between volumes to like get the next one coming in, so I can just move from one to the next. So because I'm right at the end of the second volume, which is the first Tenkaichi Budokai thing, I'm like right before where Goku and Jackie Chun do the fight in the finals.
So good.
And one thing that's really interesting is the first volume, which is just that full first story arc of Goku and Bulma going and collecting the Dragon Balls and, you know, with Emperor Pilaf at the end and all that. That's the first volume. And it's so interesting going back to that because it's so different in so many ways. It's like in significant ways and in less significant ways that I'm always fascinated by, like, old, like, the original sort of depiction of Goku, where, one, he is drawn pretty differently. Like, his hair in particular is very different. It just kind of, like, sticks straight up, and it doesn't have, like, the elegant kind of, like, curve to it, and he doesn't quite strike the right Goku silhouette, and he doesn't quite... Toriyama doesn't quite sort of center on this is how Goku's hair should look until about halfway through the tournament arc. And so that's really interesting. But it's also just fascinating seeing this, like, in, like, it's kind of like when we talked about Star Wars Episode 4 on that Star Wars podcast about going back to the original version of this thing that generated this whole franchise and trying to imagine, like, the possibilities of, like, where it could have gone and what it would have been like in other circumstances. Of it's when you read that first story arc, it's not necessarily, like, cemented to me that Goku is the protagonist of the series and that you would follow him definitely in the next story. Like, I could very easily imagine, like, that exact story arc playing out, and you get to the end, and Goku's like, I'm going to go to Muten Roshi's place and I'm going to go train with him. And Bulma's like, well, me and Yamcha are hooking up and we're going to go back to the capital and other adventures are going to happen with us. And they kind of split up. There's a very easy version of this where you follow Bulma for the next couple of chapters before she and Goku meet up again, rather than following Goku for the next couple of chapters and them meeting up that way. And it's just really interesting going back to something like that and trying to imagine the different possibilities of what could have happened, because it's very easy where we are now to think, oh, well, this is the way the story had to have been told. But when you look at that actual moment, it's really easy to imagine that it could have gone a totally different direction.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's fascinating to me because the thing to remember is that, you know, Dragon Ball Chapter 1 comes out maybe the very next week. I'd have to check the dates, but, like, right after Dr. Slump, the last chapter of that. And it, in its first arc especially, is more of a gag manga than it is the... You would not call... I mean, Dragon Ball is consistently funny, but it is not a gag manga. Whereas Dr. Slump, that's what it is. It's, there's no, like, laws of physics. There's no rules to anything. It's very... It breaks the fourth wall consistently. Dragon Ball does not as much of that as Dr. Slump, but it does that. Even in the tournament arc, there's the one where Krillin is fighting and he beats the guy because he has no nose. And it's not that he has no nose, it's that Bulma reminds him, you have no nose, you can't smell this super stinky guy. And there's just moments like that that, you know, yeah. Clearly by the time of the Z portion of the manga, you are in a very, very different place.
I mean, there's a couple of things that happen that are like the things that I always forget happen in Dragon Ball. Like, there's the whole part where there's the bunny gang, basically.
Oh, got it, yeah.
Usagi-dan, that it's just this very random portion that is on their way to getting the last Dragon Ball that is held by Pilaf's gang. And they stop in this random city. Bulma is wearing the bunny suit in, because of all the shit that happened. And she gets mistaken for being part of this gang that is run by this, like, bunny gangster who's an anthropomorphic bunny who has the magic power to, when he touches people, they turn into carrots. And Goku defeats them with the help of Yamcha. And then Goku uses the Nyoibo, or the power pole in the English dub, and uses that and extends it all the way up into the atmosphere and puts them on the moon, because there's a whole Japanese, like, legend about bunnies on the moon pounding mochi cakes. And so Goku literally leaves Earth, goes to the moon, and leaves them there, and then comes back. And it's one of those things where, as you're saying, there's, like, it's the, well, you know, Dragon Ball is never quite a gag manga. The you can see so much of the Dr. Slump in that beginning bit, because there's little gags like that. There are, there's Emperor Pilaf, his first appearance, he just straight up, there's a full page where he just breaks the fourth wall and is talking about how Mai says some joke that's like a kind of a dirty joke. And Pilaf says, you can't say that. We're in Shonen Jump. You can't just say a dirty joke like that. We need to be more respectable. And she says, I'm sorry. And she has like a little like piece of poo on a stick as like a gag. And he says, that's the exact shit I'm talking about. You can't do that. And yes. And
which is a Dr. Slump callback.
Exactly. It's a Dr. Slump callback. And so there's weird fourth wall breaking. There's like weird just like comedy, like weird little narrative cul-de-sacs, like that bunny thing, that are so unlike the narrative cul-de-sacs that Dragon Ball would kind of get into later, because it's just like, here's like two chapters of just random nothing bunny thing that never comes up again, is completely irrelevant, and it has nothing to do with the Dragon Balls. The bunny guy doesn't have a Dragon Ball. The bunny guy doesn't know what Dragon Balls are. He's just this random villain that you kind of take care of and dismiss in this little tiny two-chapter arc and then move on to where the next Dragon Ball is. It's really interesting going back to that early Dragon stuff.
Well, that's the other thing, is that it's episodic at the start.
Yeah.
That arc is... There is an arc in so much as they're finding the seven Dragon Balls, but it is... Chapters have a contained beginning, middle, end. There are... Maybe there's a two-parter in there, but for the most part, it is like... A chapter will tell a story, which is even past that arc, like where the point you are at in the tournament. We're not doing that anymore. Like, maybe you'll have a fight in a chapter, but it is very clearly a serialized ongoing story, which is what Dragon Ball is for the most part. Dr. Slump was, there's continuity, but there's really not story arcs, and it is just every week you read a new story with Arale and friends, and that's kind of how Dragon Ball started, and it is a fascinating evolution. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've been having fun doing that, and I look forward to continuing to read the manga as I go.
It's so good. He's one of the best comic artists of all time.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
All right. Okay, let's go ahead and move on. I am going to talk a little bit more about Super Smash Bros. Ultimate, which I've been playing the shit out of. I was actually kind of stunned to realize, Sean, despite all of the other shit I've been doing, I guess I've put in enough time. I checked my play clock. I'm 25 hours deep
on
Smash Ultimate in 1 week. I don't know how I did it. I don't know where the time went. It seems accurate, but man, it's crazy to me. And in that 25 hours, I feel like I've barely scratched the surface. There is so much to do in this game, because that's probably, I think, my play clock on World of Light, which it keeps separate as well. There's an overall play clock you can check, and then World of Light keeps its own one. World of Light, I'm 8 hours in on that. And I've got like 20 characters in World of Light, but you can get all 74 in World of Light. So there's a lot left to go of that part of the game. In the main mode, of main modes of the game, Classic Smash, all that, I have most of the fighters unlocked. I think I have two or three left. Like, so by the time this comes out, I will have all of them unlocked, I'm sure. So I've got most everyone out. I've played probably on every stage at this point, through World of Light and the other things, but I'm not even sure about that. There's just so much to do. Thomas and I, my brother, have spent a lot of time playing, and we've found, like, we'll go to play online, and we'll just be in chat, and we'll be talking and playing the game, and then suddenly it's an hour and a half later, and it's just like, oh my god, I didn't realize. The time just flies by, and it is such a good game, Sean. It is so good. You said this about Hitman 2 a couple weeks ago after you'd played a little bit of it, which is, you were saying, like, you weren't sure about what you were going to do about Game of the Year, because in your heart, like, Hitman 2 feels like just the best game of the year. You said something like that. That's kind of where I'm at on Smash Ultimate. It's like, I don't quite know what argument I would be making on there being a different game of the year. It's on some level, because Smash Ultimate is so refined. It is so feature-rich. Within being feature-rich, everything feels like it has a place. This is the first Smash Bros. Game where it doesn't feel like there's a single filler mode in it. You know, like, there's always in the Smash Bros. Games, there's something like Home Run Contest, or in Smash 4, there was that horrible board game mode in the Wii U one, or something like that, where you're like, this is not, or board the targets in the original N64 game, where you're like, this is fine, it's not bad, but, like, I'm not gonna play this, you know?
Yeah.
There's none of that in here. I want to play everything that the game has to offer. And there's also no filler characters. That's the most stunning thing to me about this. And I think it's kind of the most undercovered thing in a lot of the reviews I've seen so far, because those reviews had to be pumped out very fast and probably did not have a lot of time with each character. In fact, this is a great... Here's a great statistic, Sean, on how much shit is in this game. This was pointed out in a Game Explain video on YouTube, so I cannot take credit for this. But so there are 74, I believe, fighters in Smash Bros. If you spent just 20 minutes playing with every fighter, which is a very short amount of time, like play 2-3 matches with them, right? That's 25 hours. You would, if you just spent 20 minutes with each fighter, you would spend 24 hours of time. It is crazy on that level. And what I've found so far, having not spent 20 minutes with every character, but, you know, a lot of time with many of the characters, is I'm stunned by how good every character is. And it goes for the entire roster, which feels like every character feels more clearly defined to me than ever. The different categories of characters feel more defined and usable to me than ever. There's no character I've played so far where I feel like this is a filler character or this is one I can't imagine using. There are ones that are not to my personal play style, which is going to happen in any fighting game. But like I can, there is every character in this game, someone is going to love that character. And with a roster this fucking big, that is mind-boggling to me. And where I really feel it is with the newcomers. There are, I believe, of characters who are purely, completely new. You have Inkling, Isabelle, Simon and Richter, Ridley, King K. Rool, and Incineroar. And each of these characters are so good. They're so interesting. They're so fully fleshed out. They use, they take so much use of the license, whatever that is, and whatever the character is. And they're so, they're so fan servicey in the best ways, but they're also like really interesting fighters who play differently than a lot of other characters. They play differently than each other. There's so much attention to detail, a lot of gameplay depth. I could see each of these becoming a favorite. I really do like all of them. Isabelle is the most terrifying fighter in the game. I don't know if you've seen any of this, Sean, but Isabelle will kick your fucking ass. And my brother, Thomas, has gotten pretty good with Isabelle, and I don't know if I've beaten him when he's playing Isabelle, because Isabelle is terrifying. Isabelle has a fishing rod that she uses to, like, she swings it out and then picks people up with it and tosses them around. And she can also, like, plant one of those gyroid things in the ground, and then you will walk over it as a trap and it'll just launch you into the air. And there's all these things. She's terrifying. Incineroar is just really fun and fluid. Incineroar and Ridley are actually pretty similar. King K. Rool is maybe my favorite heavy in the game, because he's heavy, but he also has a mobility that a lot of the other heavies, like Bowser or some, don't have. And the biggest revelation for me is Simon and Richter. Like, I'm not a huge Castlevania fan, but I like Castlevania. Like, I like the music and the visuals and everything. And they've gotten Simon and Richter so right. Like, the walk, all of their B special moves are the different specials from the game. Like, the cross and the axe is their neutral special. My favorite one is the holy water, where they throw it on the ground and fire comes up, which someone had a great tweet about this, which that means technically every fighter in this game who is not Simon and Richter is a demon, because they are affected by holy water.
It checks out.
It checks out. But there's just, those two are the ones like I kind of want to get good at more than any of the other new ones. Just because they're so interesting from like a mechanical standpoint to me, they're really cool to play as. And I really like Richter is like a little faster, which is neat. So all of those are great. The returning characters, though, this is where I've really been surprised, is how much of the returning roster has been tweaked. Like, if a character, so they now designate characters as primary fighters and echo fighters. And echo fighters is what we used to call, like, clones. Like, in Smash Bros. Melee, there were a lot of clones. Like, Falco is clearly a clone of Fox. Pichu is a weaker clone of Pikachu, those sorts of things, right? Now they call those echo fighters, but they've also taken a lot of characters who used to be clones and said, okay, these are not echo fighters anymore. And it's not that they, like, they just were, like, trying to be prideful about it. It's that they literally changed the character enough that it's not an echo fighter. It's very clearly not a clone. So like, there are three versions of Link in this game. There's adult Link, there's young Link, and there's Toon Link. And you would think, well, young Link was a clone of Link, and then Toon Link was a replacement of young Link. Why do you need three? They've really shifted those up. Like, Link is almost a different character than he is in the other Smash Bros. Games, because he's Breath of the Wild Link now, so all of his equipment is more tied to Breath of the Wild. So like, his bombs, they're not the normal bombs, they're remote bombs. So you drop them, and then you can activate them later, and obviously people are getting good at that in really crazy ways if you watch some of the videos online. Young Link is, one, is just awesome, because it's a really cool HD version of Ocarina of Time Link. With the, he's got the Kokiri shield, which is awesome, the wooden one, and he's got fire arrows, which is really cool, and it's just a really cool version of the character who's more like the traditional Link, but also will remind you of Ocarina of Time, and he's my favorite of the three. And then you've got Toon Link, who has also been tweaked to be different, and so you have these three Links, and they're really unique from one another. And then you've got characters like Wolf and Falco and Dr. Mario, and all of those in the past were just, that's Fox, or that is Mario, just with a different skin, and that's not what they are at all anymore. Like, Dr. Mario plays really differently than regular Mario now. Like, they've taken his up B attack and completely shifted it. He does not anymore, like, Mario's up B is the one that does the coin attack on people. It doesn't do that anymore. His down A is very different. Like, there's a lot of just differences there. Wolf I just unlocked earlier today, and he is fucking awesome, and he's very much not a Fox clone anymore. He's really cool to play as. So that's all really neat. And then when you do get to the actual Echo fighters, the Echoes are really cool too, because while they are clearly clones of the basic moveset, they often have subtle movement or speed or weight differences, and they make one of the two like more preferable for a certain playstyle. So, for instance, my sort of main in the game so far is Dark Samus, because I've always been good with Samus. I love Samus as a character. I love the Metroid series. Dark Samus, one, is just really awesome. Really, really, really makes me want Metroid Prime in HD on the Switch, because they put so much detail into Dark Samus's weird, like, armor skin stuff. But Dark Samus is also, like, floatier. She's more agile than Samus. She's got different, you know, powers here and there. Like, the missiles look a little different and play a little differently. So that's really cool. And I think I prefer her just a little bit to base Samus. Or, as I mentioned earlier, Richter is quicker than Simon, and you have, like, trade-offs with power. It's really cool. It can lead to some really unexpected favorites in the roster. And, again, nothing feels like filler. Like, I've found myself, for instance, Peach is never a character I've been very good at or played much as. Daisy is an Echo who's new in this game that made me want to go play as Daisy, and I was like, this is actually pretty interesting, and I got fairly good at Daisy the other night playing online, and that was fun. Or like Roy from Fire Emblem. I've always liked, even though Roy is not in a Fire Emblem game that's ever come out in the United States. Well, okay, Kid Roy is in the epilogue of the GBA Fire Emblem, because that's a prequel to the one he's in. But Roy is otherwise, adult Roy is not in there. So I've only kind of played him out of curiosity. But now there's a clone of Roy, or an Echo, that is Crom from Fire Emblem Awakening, who's a character I love, which I believe that's Troy Baker. Gets Troy Baker into the Smash Brothers universe, which is nice. And Crom is like a slightly different clone of Roy, and he might be my new favorite of the Fire Emblem crew, of which there are, I think, 7 characters in this game. A full tenth of the roster is Fire Emblem. A little under a tenth. But yeah, it's really cool. Then you've got all the stages. They're all so great. It's easy to wish we had more purely new ones, because I think there's only 4 or 5 that are all completely new. But if you look at all the old ones, of which there are dozens and dozens, because there's over 100 stages, they've done so much graphical work to bring the graphics and the visuals up to par with the new stages. And so they all kind of look on a graphical parity with one another. And that's really neat, because that was not the case before. If you played Smash Brawl, or especially Smash 4 did this, they kind of would tend to look muddy. They looked like they had just ported the stage across. They didn't, like, replace textures and stuff. They've done a lot of that in this game to make them look really cool. You've got the stage morph feature, which is awesome. More fighting between this and Dragon Ball FighterZ, which also does a stage shift mechanic sometimes. More fighting games should do that. It's really cool. But anyway, Smash Ultimate, it is so much video game, and it's awesome, and I love it. So, yeah.
Cool.
All right. Anything else to say there?
I have not played it.
You've not played it, yeah.
Okay, here's my... Because Link was my main in Smash Brothers in Melee. I need to know 2 things. Does his side smash attack still do 2 swipes?
I don't know. I haven't played enough with him.
Okay. And do you know if his jump down A still does the Zelda 2, like, stick the sword down and kind of, like, bounce on the thing?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay, good.
I believe that's still in there. It's mostly the equipment side of things, because Link is a really interesting character in the roster at this point, because in the first 2 games, he was one of the only sword users. In the N64 game, he's the only one with a sword, and in Melee, it's him and then the 2 Fire Emblem guys. And now you've got all these Fire Emblem characters. You've got Shulk, you've got Cloud, and for all of them, the sword is much more central to their attack stuff. Whereas Link is a swordsman, but he also has all this equipment. He doesn't have a counter the way the other swordsmen have. So, like, I've actually gotten worse at Link over the years because I play the other sword characters so much, and then I go to play Link, and, like, consciously I have trouble untangling that. And I think they've done a good job of differentiating him even more here, giving you the other 2 links as options. Like, I'm curious, Sean, what you'll think of this Link, and then what you might think of, like, Young Link or something.
Yeah, because Link was always an interesting character to me, and one of the reasons why I liked him was he always felt like a character for whom his, like, special B moves are, like, really secondary to the character, which is, like, true for, like, you know, basically every character. It's your, like, normal attacks are what... As with any fighting game, your normal attacks should be your bread and butter, should be, like, the basics of what you're doing. With Link, it was always like, Like, you know, his bow and arrow can be useful in specific circumstances. The bomb can be kind of useful in specific circumstances. But those, but like the equipment and his B moves are so specialized, and other than his up B, are not usually like particularly useful for dealing damage or knocking people off the stage. They're more for like stopping someone from getting up and like canceling out a jump or like an up B attack or something like that. And it was so much about his smash attacks and his normal attacks were really powerful. That's why I like playing as him.
Yeah, Ganondorf and Zelda have also had pretty significant overhauls. Like the entire Zelda crew has been really refined, which is an interesting thing. Because there's a good amount of them. There's Zelda, there's Ganondorf, and then three Links. So there's, I guess there's five overall from that franchise. And they're all really cool. So yeah. All right, let's go ahead and move on to our main event today, Sean, which is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. This has been a good year for Spider-Man. It has been a good year for Spider-Man on this podcast, where obviously we reviewed the new game on PS4, which was outstanding. We talked about all three of the Sam Raimi films, which are really cool. You have been reading a bunch of Spider-Man comics and been telling us about those. And now, to end the year, we have what might be the best Spider-Man thing of the year. It's hard to compare this to the game, but it's really good. It's definitely competitive with that. We have Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. We will do spoilers on the movie in a little bit. Let's start with just spoiler-free reactions. Sean, I'm just going to read the first thing I tweeted out last night after seeing the movie, and then I want to hear your take. But this is definitely my first blush take. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is so ludicrously good, it makes me retroactively disappointed in the last 20 years of superhero and CGI animated films that don't possess one-tenth the aesthetic skill or imagination of this film, and in most cases, one-tenth of its heart.
Yes. Yes, that is my addition to that statement. Yes, that is all true. Yes, like one of the things that's interesting about Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is it's kind of like there are like three different sort of like ways you or like I react to the movie. There's me reacting to it as a Spider-Man fan, there's me reacting to it as a fan of good movies, and then there's me reacting to it as a fan of animated like films and TV and stuff like that. And it's, you know, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is exceptional in all three of those realms.
Yes.
As a Spider-Man fan, it has some just like ludicrous fan service that just made me smile constantly throughout the entire movie, whether it was like a small inside joke, like the representations of all the different characters, like them making Prowler really cool was a first in my experience for Spider-Man, where Prowler is the purple villain in the movie, and Prowler kind of sucks. I've been reading, I took a bit of a break on that Spider-Man comic reread. But I was reading a lot of that Prowler stuff, and fucking Prowler's so dumb and lame, and they make Prowler super cool. All the different spider people represented are fucking awesome. Miles is great. And so as a Spider-Man fan, it does all that stuff perfectly. But then as a fan of good movies and just good storytelling on its own, I think the movie has such a sense of heart and purpose with telling Miles' story. It is, while there are a lot of different spider people in the movie, it is very much Miles' story. It's his origin story and how this version of Miles Morales becomes Spider-Man by the end. I think the message of the movie that anybody can be Spider-Man, there's nothing special about Peter Parker, that anybody who can take that kind of pain and trauma and use it to help people and use it for good, that's what makes someone Spider-Man, and it has nothing to do with the superpowers necessarily. Like, the superpowers just make it easier for you to do that, but it's about having the heart and the conviction to be able to do good in the world. And I think it tells that story through the sort of character arc of Miles beautifully. And then there's just being a fan of animation and being someone who has been perennially disappointed in Western CG animation and the very sort of like dead-end like block we reached with 3D CG animation with fucking like Toy Story or however early it was.
Toy Story was like the easiest thing to do in CGI is to have people who are literally made of plastic, because we can do that, because in the early days we couldn't do textures. And now it's, we just make all people look like plastic. It's a very weird thing.
Yeah, and so basically every 3D CG animated movie in the West has looked like Toy Story, basically. And I know you're a big fan of the How to Train Your Dragon movies, and I haven't seen them. But like the trailer for How to Train Your Dragon 3 played before Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and it looked good and it looked really well made. And I'm not trying to say that it looked bad, but it looked exactly how you would expect a movie like that to look. That trailer into Spider-Man was ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, let me recap this a little more because maybe I watch more animation than you do.
Yeah.
It's just that, like, I don't want to be completely dismissive. There have obviously been a lot of really great CGI animated films, but I do think there's a similarity. There's an aesthetic box you just don't go out of much. Like, Brad Bird CGI people in, like, The Incredibles or Ratatouille look very different than, you know, How to Train Your Dragon CGI people, but they still look like CGI people, you know? Whereas, you know, if you looked at a Looney Tunes cartoon versus a Disney cartoon back in the day, those were the easiest things in the world to distinguish between, right? Because mm-hmm. you just had a different style with hand-drawn. Or if you go watch anime, if you throw five different darts at five different anime shows, there's a good chance none of those are going to look like one another, right?
Yeah.
They might, but they might not, which is not the case in America. Like, How to Train Your Dragon, I agree, the people are not the most interesting character designs in that. What that series does is more of a cinematography thing that makes it stand out, is that, like, literally Roger Deakins, of all people, does, like, helps with the camera work in it, and the camera feels much more alive and dynamic in those films. And that's what distinguishes it. It's not necessarily the, like, texture of the animation itself. That's what is so interesting about Into the Spider-Verse, is it's kind of the first major American animated film. Like, the only other one I could kind of think of is something like Rango, but that kind of just went for photorealism. What this does is it completely upends the box and says, here's the box we've all been working in, we're going to go over there. We're going to go really far over there. You know, the people aren't going to look like CGI people. Like, even down to, like, the way we're going to do blur on screen, how we're going to do dimensionality, how we're going to do color latexes and things like that, or lattices, and all these different things. Like, it's all completely different. And then you get into, like, editing and stylization and all the other things. It has virtually no similarities with other American CGI animation, and that's amazing.
Yeah, and there is just this, like, absurd creative vitality that goes through the whole movie. And it's the kind of thing that you could, I mean, well, you shouldn't do this because the voice acting and the sound effects and the music is all so great, but you could turn the music off and no subtitles or anything and just watch the movie and have an incredible time just looking at, like, the visual feast of what they are presenting to you and all the different visual inspirations and that, like, sense of the comic book come to life It's one of the coolest animated things I've ever seen in my whole life. It's just incredible. Every single second looks gorgeous. It is not just like flashy style. It is substantive. It is used to tell things about the story, to communicate humor and communicate drama and communicate character and communicate plot really effectively and powerfully. And it's just a fucking cliche to say, but it's done nowhere more appropriate than this movie. It is a visual feast. It is a feast for your eyes. It is something that, like, I want to be watching it right now. I wish I could have a second screen my whole life somewhere just playing Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse on loop so I could just look at that and just be like, fucking holy shit, that looks so good.
Yes. It's also, like, tell me if I'm wrong, Sean. This feels like the most anyone has tried to match the aesthetic substance of an actual comic book in a major, like, Hollywood production since Batman 1966. Like, maybe the Tim Burton things, but he's doing his own thing. It's Frank Miller-esque, but it's not Frank Miller. This is, we're really taking inspiration from comics. And yeah, the closest other one would be, like, Ang Lee's stupid fucking Hulk movie that just did boxes every once in a while.
Yeah, like, this, it's, like, it's not just having, like, frames in the, like, within each other and having narrative boxes and stuff like that. And just, like, a lot of the narrative devices and the tone of the movie is all very comic booky in a very savvy way that feels like a really good modern comic book and a very good modern Spider-Man comic book. But it's just like the texture of the image itself. Like, it feels palpable in a, like, pulpy way. In that, like, it feels like it's on pulp paper. It feels like it has, you know, like, when going back to that Spider-Man podcast episode I referenced earlier about Dragon Ball stuff. you know, I was showing you those the original issue of Spider-Man from the 60s, and why I really wanted to get the like PDF versions of those and like the scans, the digital scans versus reading the digitally recolored comics available on Marvel, was because there is a certain texture to the paper that affects everything about the way those images look, particularly the coloring and the dots, and all of that has such a specific look, and it feels so incredibly physical. Whereas, you know, modern comics, there's a lot of advantages of digital coloring, but one thing that is lost is a certain tangible quality. And I feel like Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse regains and, like, uses that very tangible quality. And that's one of the things that's nice about it. I think it being 3D animation as opposed to it, them doing, like, traditional 2D animation that can be very effective at capturing the comic book look for obvious reasons because they're both 2D. But this, it's like the characters feel like they exist in this 3D physical space you can touch. And that is really valuable to me. And I think it is able to, through that, capture something about the comic book aesthetic that no other movie has ever been able to capture.
I mean, it feels like a comic book come to life. And that sounds like an insipid thing to say, like what you said about a visual feast. But that is what it is. Like, people use that term to say, like, it's colorful. It's like a comic book come to life. No, no, no. This looks like a comic book got, you know, radioactive acid thrown on it and became a thing, you know? Like, that's what it is. And that's an amazing... No one's tried that before, you know? Like, we have some adaptations that are really visually striking. Ironically enough, they tend to be for television. Like, I think Batman 66 and Batman the Animated Series are probably the most engaged with the actual aesthetics of their comic books. And those aren't movies. Like, movies... Like, if you were an alien and came and saw, like, our most dominant... you know, pop culture genre right now is superhero movies, but you didn't know comics were a thing humans consumed, and you watched every MCU movie, you still would not know comics are a thing humans consumed, because they're just not, like, and obviously they are informed by the comics writ large, but they are not informed by the medium that is comic books. Do you see what I mean by the difference there?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's like what you're saying, it's the MCU movies are heavily informed by the content of the comic books from which they originate, and particularly the characters, and that's why they're very successful, is that they take what worked about those characters in that medium and translate that into these really lovable and credible characterizations in the movies that keeps people wanting to see the next film because they want to see Captain America and they want to see Iron Man and they want to see Thor. So Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, like, it is... like, it's so self-knowing about its origin as a comic book, like, quite literally, in that it every time it tells the origin story of another one of the Spider-Man characters in the movie, it cuts to, like, a desk or something, and a new, like, Spider-Man number one is thrown down, but this one has Spider-Ham on the cover, this one has Spider-Woman on the cover, this one has Spider-Man Noir on the cover, and it plays that joke for every single Spider-Man that's in the movie. And it's so, again, it's so knowing about where it comes from and celebrating everything about that, that if, yeah, like you're saying in that alien example, you would have to know, like, 3 minutes into the movie, Spider-Man of the Spider-Verse, the comic books exist, because comic books are everywhere in this movie. I mean, fucking Miles, early on, when he first gets his spider powers, learns and tries to replicate things that he sees in an in-universe Spider-Man comic. That is, like, I suppose in that universe, someone is trying to figure, like, imagine what would Spider-Man's first day as Spider-Man have been like, and wrote a comic book about it. And so he's actually reading this comic book and getting information from that. Like, the comic bookness of it is suffused throughout every single element of the film.
And again, it's so cool, like, because it is just so rare. It is crazy that you have to go back to the 90s and then the 60s, and really that it's only with Batman to find other things that were like, we're gonna pull. And with Batman, it's more of an aesthetic thing. With the 60s one, though, they you have the BAMs and the Kerplams and just the way they do, like, the color scheme and things like that, or like the tilted frames sometimes. But again, they did not have the technical advancements we have now to do this with Into the Spider-Verse. I'm gonna throw a stat at you here, Sean.
Okay.
First off, would you and I both agree, let's just set a baseline here, this is the most visually arresting and engaging comic book movie ever made?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like that's not even really in question. I would go somewhere in the same realm as maybe The Dark Knight on IMAX, but it's not this. This movie cost $90 million to make.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, $90 million is a lot of dollars. I would love to have $90 million. You would love to have $90 million.
Think of all the Hitman I could have. I could just buy my... I could fund my own Hitman game with $90 million.
You could do, like, a Battle Royale setup where you, like, get real people onto a map.
And yes.
You hunt for sport. No. $90 million is a lot. Superhero movies routinely cost $200 million, $250 million. For Avengers Infinity War, $350 million. Animated movies routinely cost $150 million, $200 million. I believe one of the most expensive movies of all time is Disney's Tangled for reasons no one will ever understand. It cost $300 million. This cost $90 million. That's the best return on investment for like a blockbuster I've ever fucking seen in this day and age. That's amazing.
Yeah. And, one of the things that's really heartening about it is they've already, before the movie even came out, they greenlit a sequel and are looking at doing a Spider-Woman spinoff also.
That's how good all the different Spider people are in this. I want a spinoff of every goddamn one of them. They don't all need to be features, but like, you know, I need, before Spider-Man Homecoming 2, they need to have a Peter Porker, like, short. Like a 10-minute animated movie that they put before Spider-Man Homecoming 2. I guess it's called Spider-Man Far From Home. We know the title now. But before Spider-Man Far From Home, there should be a 10-minute animated short about Peter Porker. And if they don't have that, they're doing it wrong.
Yeah, no, like I agree. They should do a fucking TV show or something. They should do little shorts. They should do something. They should just get some great anime studio out of Japan to just do a Penny Parker anime. I so desperately want that.
All right, we're verging into spoiler territory here. So before we get into spoilers, one thing I really quickly want to do is just make sure we name the people who made the movie, because I think this is getting lost in the equation a little bit, which happens with animation because animation directors are not like as famous sometimes. But this had a trio of directors, Bob Persichetti, Peter Ramsey, and Rodney Rothman. It was written by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, and Rodney Rothman, the co-director. And man, crazy, crazy amount of talent. Each one of these guys should be getting gig upon gig after this. Like, because that's the thing, is also like, this is a crazy acclaimed movie. It's been getting not just critical acclaim, but critical awards. I think there's already a growing sense that if this does not win the Oscar for Best Animated Feature, something is seriously awry. It won't. The Incredibles 2 is going to win that because it's the Pixar movie for the year. That will be stupid. This makes The Incredibles 2 look like a direct-to-video sequel. It looks so anemic in comparison. But yeah, this is such a good movie. If you're going to bow out for now because we're about to get into spoilers and you haven't seen it, you should. You should bow out, go see the movie, come back, listen to the rest of this. It's a great film. And it's kind of the rare comic book movie that I would recommend to just about anyone. Like, you know, with an Infinity War or an Ant-Man or something, we have to be very careful about, like, you know, it's for a certain type. I mean, Infinity War grossed $2 billion, so I guess it's not that niche. But you know what I mean. Like, you have to have seen a lot of movies. There's a lot of people in my life I know who just don't like superheroes. I think just about anyone could enjoy Into the Spider-Verse. It's that kind of good.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And it's not contingent upon you having any, like, knowledge of Spider-Man outside of, like, the knowledge of Spider-Man that literally every single person on the planet has, right?
Yes.
Like, it explains everything about what you need to know about Spider-Man within the movie and just plays off of your, like, innate understanding of the character through existing in popular culture.
All right. So let's go ahead and talk about the movie. Spoilers from here on out, where they will come in. One of the things that is really striking about this to me, Sean, just as a piece of storytelling, is how ridiculously polished it is. And that's one of the striking things that you get out of animation, is animated movies, they can be crap, obviously. You know, all the DreamWorks movies that aren't How to Train Your Dragon exist. But a lot of animated movies tend to be just narratively a lot more secure because they take longer to make. You know, you cannot crap out a script and, like, rush into production. That's just not how animation works. You can't start an animated movie without a script the way you can sometimes with live-action films. You know, like, I think one of the reasons why Pixar was seen as, like, so revolutionary in the early 2000s, like, they're great storytellers. I don't know if it was necessarily that. I mean, those people were obviously very, very talented, but part of it was just that, well, yes, when you take 5 years to make a movie, you're probably going to spend more time thinking about your story, and you have to spend that amount of time making an animated movie like this. And this is the, as we've said before, it is utterly baffling that it took this long to have a theatrically animated superhero movie, the last one based on a pre-existing property being like, you know, Batman Mask of the Phantasm. It's been a long time. There should be more. Animation fits comic books, one might say. But we finally have one, and that's one of the things you get is you're like, oh, right, this is a superhero movie made with the polish of a animated movie, and that's a really refreshing thing for me. Like, just how much, like, there's such economy to the movie. Every scene has weight. There's really no wasted space. There's no wasted gags. There's no wasted character moments. It's very well paced. Its themes are so well laid out. Its story is so well laid out. And it makes you look at something like an Avengers Infinity War that is really good. I really loved that movie. It's a lot of fun. But you can see where, like, this is not a script they spent 2 years writing, you know?
Right.
Or plenty of good... There's less good superhero movies, too, we could point to that are more clearly disastrous. But even with, like, really good ones, good live-action movies don't tend to have this level of polish to me. This one has that.
Yeah, and I think it's a combination of that they take so long to make, and, like, since you're animating it, like, people have to sit down and craft every single moment. Like, you can't... obviously, like, this is very reductive to the process of filming a live-action movie, but you can't just, like, go to a location, put some actors on screen, and start filming something, and then say, we'll figure it out in the edit, and just, like, film a bunch of scenes and be like, oh, we can cut out that subplot, oh, we can bring this in. It's like... what you're animating, you've storyboarded the whole thing, you've gone over it over and over again, because you're not going to spend, you know, millions of dollars paying people to animate scenes that you're going to fucking cut.
Whereas generally speaking, there's no such thing as a deleted scene in an animated movie.
Exactly. Like, you might have, like, trimmed some things in eventual edit, be like, maybe, like, in context, this was, like, we should trim this shot a little bit or something like that. But yeah, any deleted scene or something is, like, a weird animatronic that was aborted, like, 25% into the production of the film and is so far behind where the actual movie was that it doesn't even really make sense as a deleted scene anymore. And so the process, like, the laborious process of having to craft the movie from nothing also means that you then don't ever run into scenarios where it's like, oh, well, we don't have this actor for this week, so, you know, and unfortunately we're, like, filming on this location and we need, you know, there's, like, all the practicalities of live action filmmaking that can change things, whereas with animation it's, we are making everything from the ground up, every single element of the frame, every single line of dialogue, every single scene transition, everything about what the movie is has been handcrafted by these people from the ground up. Nothing is just given. You don't just have a set. You don't just have, a character aesthetic from an actor. You don't have any of that. Everything has to be crafted from nothing. And so that's one of those elements that gives animated, like, content. I think that element of, like, when it's, particularly when it's a movie and they've had all this time to do it and have been time to redo it and rethink how they're doing it and reapproach it in different ways and get that whole process, it has this incredibly slick feel to it. And as you said, every single scene, every single moment feels like it has weight and purpose, and it builds to something greater about the movie. And so that is on full display in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. And the other thing that is so impressive about it is, this is one thing I was thinking about while watching the movie, was, like, you know, in relation to my Doctor Who fandom, is it reminded me a little bit of Doctor Who, because Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, like with Doctor Who, has bitten off way more than most things could ever even think of chewing, because this is a movie that has, how many Spider-Mans does this movie have? It has Miles, it has original Peter, it has the old Peter that comes in, it has Gwen Spider-Woman, it has Spider-Man Noir, it has Penny Parker, and it has Spider-Ham.
Yes, so that's seven. Yeah,
is seven spider people in the main movie, and then a cameo of Spider-Man 2099 in the post-credit scene,
and by Spider-Man of the 60s. Don't forget.
Yes, that's a fair point. Also, but in the main movie, there are seven spider people you have to juggle. No fucking movie has to do that. Nothing has to have seven versions of the main character. One of whom is a fucking pig. One of whom is an anime girl with a mech. One of whom is, like, a weird parody of noir fiction voiced by Nicolas Cage, who exists in a world that's entirely in black and white, and so he's utterly captivated by a Rubik's Cube because he can't see the color in it. Like, it's such an absurd premise. The movie is so surreal in its construction. It's, like, it's this, like, really strange postmodern animated film that, like, is actually feels postmodern in a legitimate way, and,
yes,
like, what it's interested in and the very form in which it exists, which is one of the reasons why I think it's getting that kind of critical attention, is that otherwise, you know, weird comic book bullshit, most, like, major film critics have no idea it even exists, would ever be interested in it. And it would normally, I feel like, sort of, like, pass this movie over and not pay attention to it the way they'd pass over most other what are, like, lower budget, not particularly heavily advertised at first movies. I feel like this eventually got buzzed because of its aesthetic, but it draws so much attention to itself because it feels so critically informed about itself, the world it exists in, and it just is so smart about being about Spider-Man and being about about comic books and being about superheroes and approaching these things in like what is a like legitimately sophisticated fashion while also having the crowd-pleasing elements of you have seven fucking spider people in this movie. How awesome is that?
Oh, I think I could totally, if I had the time and energy at this point at the end of the year, write an article about how Into the Spider-Verse feels to me like my like the absolute best version of every pop culture trend we have right now in movies. Mm-hmm. Like the meta narratives, which this movie is heavily into, right? Because Spider-Man is a thing, it's very meta about the nature of Spider-Man. The direct address to the audience, the gendered and racialized recasting of pop culture figures, you know, which is a big thing right now. It does all of that with such aplomb, and it uses all those different powers for such good. Like, I think the thing that summarizes my emotional reaction to this movie more strongly than anything is that this is a movie that both has Peter Porker Spider-Ham in it, and a moment at the end where Miles just gives a little monologue about, like, I never thought I could be Spider-Man, but I can be Spider-Man, anyone can be Spider-Man, and I teared up at that. I really legitimately, there were tears in my eyes because Miles is such a good character. That is such a beautiful message to have. The movie earns that message so fucking hard. It does not phone in an inch of that. And the presence of Peter Porker is not a contrast to that. It is helping to build that message. It can be silly. It can be a tonal diversion. But it's also like, weirdly, if Peter Porker weren't there, I don't know if the message would resonate as well. Now, there are other versions of Spider-Man in this that help that message resonate even more. But, you know, Peter Porker and Miles Morales are about as different as they get.
Yes, yeah, and, you have a literal cartoon pig man on screen.
Yeah, and whereas Miles feels like the most real character maybe I've ever seen in a superhero movie. Like, honestly, but certainly in a Spider-Man movie. Because you have, like, you know, Tobey Maguire's Peter Parker is great, but he's John Hughes' Peter Parker, you know? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, Andrew Garfield's Peter Parker is the punk kid you want to punch in the face, Peter Parker. You know, Tom Holland feels mostly like a real kid, but, you know, he's a movie kid. Miles Morales feels like someone I could go meet or, you know, have a conversation with or see on the streets of New York.
Yeah, or, like, you know, we've spent time with teenagers through, like, the education stuff, and Miles 100%. You know, there's that great scene with the teacher where she says, you know, like, he has gotten a zero on this true-false quiz. It's like, if you blindfolded someone, gave them a true-false quiz, what would they get? 50%, exactly, and she changes the zero into 100. And, like, there was, like, something in that interaction in that moment that felt very honest to me in this, like, very heightened movie superhero kind of way. And it's, you know, part of the whole sort of, like, almost montage at the beginning of the movie setting up Miles as a character. But it feels so honest and true. And like you said, there's such a reality to Miles and his vulnerabilities. And I love just that, you know, how his sort of like character weakness of like kind of self-doubt and not wanting to put himself out there as much and being afraid kind of being at this like really prestigious school and being afraid of being Spider-Man and wanting to be those things but can't quite put his all into it is so relatable and is so true about that character.
Absolutely. Let's talk about Miles because, good God, they nailed it so hard. I mean, I think people are going to have a real reaction to this film, and I think it's because they got Miles Morales right, and they finally did a non-Peter Parker Spider-Man. They took this very popular alternate incarnation, and they did it as right as anyone could possibly do it, I think, in a major motion picture. And they did it in the same movie where they had seven other Spider-Men. There's no reason you have to do Miles Morales and seven other Spider-Men. My understanding is that Ultimate Spider-Man does not have seven other Spider-Men when Miles is created.
No, because okay. It's just him because the last Spider-Man was murdered, and so yes. it's just Miles coming up as Spider-Man.
But they blend it all so perfectly, and, you know, if I had any one worry going into the Spider-Verse, because it looked awesome, my one worry was that, is the Miles Morales story going to get overwhelmed by all the other stuff, you know? I was definitely concerned about that. And not only does it not, but the other stuff really bolsters Miles' story. I'm amazed at what focus the film has from beginning to end of, it feels like the central question of every scene is how do we further Miles' character arc? And we can have other character arcs. Like, I think Gwen Stacy in this is a really cool character. I think the older Peter Parker, voiced by Jake Johnston, he's got a great arc in this. His last moment, or the second to last moment, when Peter throws him back through the dimensional portal, really moved me, because it's like, I love the idea of this, of a Spider-Man who is that vulnerable about the simple act of going and talking to Mary Jane. We haven't seen that before, on film at least. And yet, all of that stuff is ultimately, it is all in favor of Miles' character arc. Like, there's a lot of time spent on Miles and his family, and getting to know his dad, and his mom, and his uncle, and oh my god, his dad has a scene in this that will break your fucking heart. It is beginning of up-level animated heartstring tugging, you know? And also just a level of, like, real that you don't usually see in this kind of movie, of, like, a conversation. I mean, because it's an allegory for a kind of conversation that sadly is common in America in a lot of ways, and the way they do it is just beautiful and touching and raw and moving. And I think Miles just, I think Shameik Moore is the guy who plays him. It's a great vocal performance, just perfect voice for that character. I came out of this with, like, I am now a Miles Morales fan. He's my favorite Spider-Man. I fucking love this Spider-Man. He is so awesome.
And I think it's just so awesome, and it's so heartening to see this happen, because we so rarely see a development in comic books trickle out into the larger popular culture anymore. It, like, almost never happens. It's almost never happened since, like, the Silver Age of comics. And there's, like, a couple of things that will, like, sort of sneak into the movies that maybe people kind of get to know, something like X-23 and Logan a little bit,
probably,
but not
the,
really.
Probably the latest thing would be Guardians of the Galaxy, which is an older comic, but the team that is in the movies is from, like, 2009, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's a good catch, yes. Guardians of the Galaxy is probably the other one that has kind of done this, and, like, Rocket Raccoon specifically and Groot from Guardians have broached back into the larger culture. But something that's cool about Miles specifically is that he is one of what is a number of different attempts at reconfiguring different superheroes in comic books, that, like, you know, whether it's Thor, and we had a female version of Thor that was Jane for a little bit. We've had, I think, a female version of Wolverine. There was a black woman who was Iron Man for a little bit. I don't think she is anymore in the comics. I don't really keep up with modern Marvel comics, so I don't know the ins and outs of all of this stuff. But there are lots and lots and lots of different, and this isn't even just a modern phenomenon, it's happened all the time. There's so many different Hulks and Wolverines and stuff, that have different characters that have taken on those mantles in different ways throughout history, and throughout the history of those comic books, and none of those have ever really broken outside of that barrier. You know, you've never really seen them be depicted in any other way. And to have Miles in both Spider-Man, the video game earlier this year, in which he's a great, awesome character that, you know, I bet Insomniac is super stoked that this movie is as awesome as it is, because it just makes the hype for their next game, where you're definitely going to play as Miles, that much higher. But you have him in that game, and then now you have him starring in this movie, and it just feels like, okay, he is here. This is not a character that maybe pops up in, like, a couple of episodes of a Spider-Man cartoon, and that's as far outside the comics he gets. It feels like Miles is here. He is, like, a pop cultural fixture, not just in the comic books, but outside that space. And that's so cool to see. And it's such a testament to the quality of that character and the people that have taken on, like, the role and, like, the message of that character and brought him outside of that original comic book form, that it just, he feels so alive and so fully formed and so real that I can very much imagine a lot of, like, younger people watching this movie coming out of it not having realized Miles maybe was a thing going in, and then coming out and being like, is Miles in any of the comic books? Because I have to read a fucking Miles Morales Spider-Man comic book now.
Oh, I felt that, because I've got the Marvel Unlimited app, and now I'm like, I gotta find, like, he's in Ultimate Spider-Man, right? That's where he comes from?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like I've gotta go research, like, where does Miles Morales start? Because I would really love to read some of his early stuff, because, again, I haven't read it all. It feels like this feels more informed by, like, actual comic story arcs than a lot of comic book movies are, I'm guessing. Yeah.
Well, the Spider-Verse thing itself is from a comic book arc, although that comic book arc is not about Miles, but he's in it.
Yeah. But just, like, the general, like, obviously the general tenets of Miles' life are so much here, like, what they are in the original. It's Brian Michael Bendis, right?
Yes, yeah, he did the Ultimate Comic Spider-Man one, yeah.
Who, there's a great call-out to him. There's a B. Bendis in Miles' phone in this. I don't know if you noticed that, but I like
yes,
that.
Yes, yeah, there's some good... There's a bunch of Easter eggs in the different... Because there's a handful of phone contact lists you see, and there's like a Steve Ditko one, there's a Brian Michael Bendis one. It's good.
I like the idea that Miles can just call up Brian Michael Bendis.
Yes, that's in a fourth wall, metaphysical breaking kind of way, I feel like he can.
Yeah. All right. What else should we say about Miles Morales and like his story arc in here? Because it really is like, I think I love that the movie takes its... It's a while into the movie before we get the multiverse thing. Like, they don't just hit the ground running with that. It is, you spend a while with Miles just on the ground being a kid. I love the different details of his story that he has. He has, like, Peter Parker has a happy family life in that he has an uncle and an aunt who love him. But it is slightly different. It's not his mom and dad. Uncle Ben does not survive long in any incarnation. Miles has a happy family. He's got a dad who loves him, and he's got a mom who loves him, and he's got a good home, and you know, he's got his head on straight. He is not, he's a little awkward at school, but he's not like savagely bullied or anything. He's adjusting. I like the detail in this that he's off at this kind of like quasi boarding school he has to stay at during the week, and he doesn't feel like he fits in there. Just all those details of him being a kid feel so genuine to me that by the time you throw him into, he's been bit by a spider and now he is in an adventure with Spider-Man, you care about him so much. And it's like, it's that meat and potatoes origin story storytelling that we don't do much anymore because we don't do origin stories much anymore. And it's like, this is refreshing. This is really good.
Yeah, and it's that thing of, like, the movie... I love that the movie pokes fun at the origin story thing of, like, you know, the first thing that happens in the movie is that universe's Peter Parker saying, okay, let's do it one last time. I was bit by a radioactive spider. Uncle Ben died. Great power, great responsibility. And kind of, like, works through some of that stuff showing... I love that they show, like, a bunch of scenes from the movies to, like, feel like, oh, this is, like, this weird idealized movie version of Peter Parker that exists in this universe that's blonde, that I find very funny that he's blonde. But yeah, so you have that and it kind of pokes fun at the origin story thing, but then the movie itself actually does like this really effective, super efficient origin story for Miles. And part of it is that since people don't really know Miles that well and his origin has not been codified the way the Spider-Man origin is so codified now, down to you can never not have Uncle Ben say great power, great responsibility, even though he never originally said it, you know, like pop culture has shaped the Spider-Man origin in a specific way. Miles doesn't have that. And so I've not read a bunch of the Miles comics, but this is not exactly what he does. This is not exactly his thing. And I love, like, his family is so well realized. His dad, Jefferson Davis. This is the second time Jefferson Davis has been awesome this year. He's awesome in this movie. He's awesome in the fucking game. And then his uncle. And I love that dichotomy between his relationship with his father that is, like, a little bit cold and a little bit frustrating for Miles because his dad's a cop and is this kind of authority figure, and Miles has to have a certain kind of relationship with him. And then he has that very relaxed, easy relationship with his uncle, who gets to be the very cool uncle because he's the guy that Miles goes to when he's too stressed out at home or at the school. And that dichotomy, like, does so much, I think, to build up Miles for me, in that he is the kind of kid who's not going to really confront his dad about these issues. He's the one who's going to go off to the other, like, the easy father figure in his life that's not going to do, like, the real parenting job, because it allows Miles to kind of avoid the, like, direct reality of the situation and like, kind of elide the responsibility that he's inside of, and that's really effective.
So Jefferson Davis, spoiler for the video game, he dies in the video game this year. Is that a common part of Miles' origin story, that his dad dies?
I think it's his mom that actually dies. It's been a long time since I read. I read, like, the first couple of issues of Ultimate Comics Spider-Man, and then I don't remember.
Because
I think it's his mom.
I like that his family doesn't die in this. Like, I know Uncle Aaron does, but it's a materially different thing when it's not his literal parent figure, you know? Like someone has to die. That's actually one of the smartest meta things in this movie is all of the spider people being like, we've all lost someone, right? And for him, it's his Uncle Aaron. But I like that he has two parents. There's something kind of quietly radical about, like, no, he has a happy family life. Like, his parents are both there and they love him. Like, there's not enough of that. Like, many superheroes, many Disney heroes, just heroes in general always have to have an absent father or mother figure. And I really hope if they do sequels to this, they don't, like, wind up killing one of his parents. I want him to have his parents. It is so nice for him to just have his parents. That is because we don't get that enough, you know? It's good.
Yeah, I felt the exact same thing watching it of knowing that somebody has to die. And I'm like, I don't want his mom or his dad to die. Like, I feel like they, not just in the way of like it would be so tragic, but it wouldn't feel right. And I think you're right. There's something about, I think it helps build the like message of the movie. And that, not to say that, you know, there's the not like 16-year-old kids that have had a parent that's died. Obviously that happens. But I feel like the tragedy of the, like, of someone close to you, but like not the immediate, it's my mother, father, brother, sister kind of thing. That's like, it's just outside of the immediate family scope that it means like most people at that age have someone in their life that has died that is not necessarily like the most important person in their entire world, which is what your parent usually is. And so that, I feel like, makes the trauma feel a little bit more universal to me. And it's not like Batman, oh, I was 8 years old and both my parents were gunned down in front of me. Again, not to say that that doesn't, that obviously that happens, but that is not a normal trauma for people to experience. And I like that the traumas that Miles experiences are heightened a bit because of the comic book world, but they feel like these are the kinds of traumas that most people experience at this age. And the issues that he's having are issues that most people experience. And he doesn't have, like, you know, all the guilt and the tremendous responsibility that Peter Parker normally has. It is a normal level of responsibility, a normal level of trauma. And even that is difficult for people to deal with. And that's what makes it empowering for him to be able to get over it.
Yeah, and I think it's also because Miles reads very young to me in this movie. He feels like a real kid, and this is part of the benefit of doing live action, of doing animation. You know, the actor who plays him, Shameik Moore, is I think like 23, 24, so he's a little older, but you wouldn't know it. It's just his voice, and he sounds the age, and they can animate him to be whatever age they want. And this is obviously a problem with Spider-Man in general, is Spider-Man is typically depicted, in the origin at least, as a high schooler, right?
Yeah.
That's hard to do in a movie, because you can't just get a kid out of high school and make them act all the time. So like Tobey Maguire, they went the John Hughes route, and that works totally fine for what it is. Andrew Garfield, they didn't know what the fuck they were doing, that didn't work. Spider-Man Homecoming and the Tom Holland stuff, that works really well. That's about as well as you can do in live action, but Tom Holland is still, he's not literally 16, and Tom Holland also, because he is a Hollywood star, he doesn't necessarily feel just like a kid down the block. He feels like a heightened version of that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not criticizing him as an actor. There's no way around this. Unless you're doing like a super low budget indie thing or a documentary, it's really hard to capture an authentic kid on film, you know? And what they do here is he feels like an authentic kid, because they can make him whatever age they want, and they can make him as authentic as they want him to be. And so, you know, there are definitely some traumatic moments in this movie, like when they just straight up kill Peter Parker, like that's brutal. I know that is a typical part of the Miles Morales origin story, is that his Spider-Man dies, but I thought they were going to like fling him into another dimension or something. I didn't think they were going to go that far, especially with Kingpin just beating him to death. So there's some brutal moments. But if this Miles Morales, who felt this much like a 15-year-old kid to me, his dad died, I don't know how you get... That's what the movie's about at that point. Like, you can't have him be Spider-Man. He would be broken inside, because that's what you would be at that age if your beloved father or mother died. So I just think all of that ties into it. It's again, it is crazy. This is a movie with multiple dimensions and fucking Peter Parker. It also has an emotional reality to it that most superhero movies don't have. Just they can't quite get there. And this has it.
Yeah, and I think part of it is that, like, that the weird, heightened, ridiculous comic book stuff helps make that emotional reality somehow more potent and, like, feel more real.
It's the anchor, you know? Like, there's not as much... Like, again, I love something like Infinity War. It's a ton of fun. I don't think an Infinity War has the same kind of anchor where you can come back to something and it pulls you to reality the same way, right? It is all big, kind of candy-colored. It's not all fun. There's some really dark moments in Infinity War. But, you know, there's not, like, they can't go home and have, like, Tony Stark talking to his dad about the death of his uncle, and it's, like, this thing that is your emotional anchor to the whole thing, right?
It's one of the things that works about it being Spider-Man and the Spider-Man character is, it, like, Spider-Man is always grounded in a more familiar, like, home reality that he's, you know, not out in space fighting demon monsters. Sometimes he is.
Yeah.
But, like, generally speaking, he's like, hey, I'm the friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. I'm swinging around taking care of, like, normal everyday stuff. And then every once in a while, the Kingpin builds a multidimensional fucking crazy machine so he can have his family back. And I get wrapped up in that. But, like, really, that's not what I should be dealing with.
Yeah. And so just to stay on Miles for a minute longer, it's... it's all of this is the basis, and the way it evolves over the course of the movie, I think, is so well done. I love how much time they spend before they really let him cut loose and be Spider-Man, because you have all these other spider people to do a lot of the superheroics, so you can kind of let Miles really grow as a character in the background. And when it finally comes time in the third act for him to get a costume, spray paint the costume, put it on, try out his cool new invisibility and electric powers, and you get that amazing shot of him diving off the building for the first time, I don't think I've ever in my life felt that much emotion at someone donning a superhero costume. It's just never hit me that hard.
I'm with you. And it was that thing of when they, you know, they get to Spider Peter's like secret spider lair that I thought was, I love the like idea that this is a universe where there was like this perfect Peter Parker down to his like perfect movie blonde hair. And he has this like Batman, I mean, what feels like it's a parody of the Bat Lair, like down, like I wish they had like a giant penny in there just to be like, this is the Bat Cave. Like he's got the fucking Spider-Mobile and shit in there. He's got this like fucking motorcycle. And then he's got the Batman that like the Batman animated series always uses, or like Batman Beyond specifically used so well, of like the glass cases with all the different suits. And when you have that shot, I'm like, oh, he's 100%. This must be like, there's going to be this Miles Morales suit is going to come back here later in the movie and like find that one and be like, this is going to be my Spider-Man suit. And I thought it was so smart that they didn't exactly do that. That is where he gets his spider suit from, but he spray paints it, and that the like, you know, the Miles Morales suit is like mostly black with kind of like red highlights. And I love that some of the red highlights are just where the spray paint hasn't quite covered yet. So like on the edges of the hands and stuff. It's such a cool way of evoking the Miles Morales Spider-Man design while keeping it really original for this movie. I just thought that was such a slick touch.
It's such a slick touch. It's so character motivated. The music they use in that sequence is amazing. I mean, that shot, it's literally a shot you could not get in live action. The upside down, him falling in slow motion, the cityscape behind him. It's almost like Andy Warhol-esque with all like the signs and stuff, like this beautiful piece of pop art. And the scope of that, the emotionality of it, and him being like, just coming into his own as Spider-Man, it is so well paced out, and it is delivered on so completely, and then everything in the final act builds on that so beautifully. I've never felt an origin story have this much weight to it, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
So all of that is great, but then we do have all the crazy multiverse stuff. So there's the whole scene where he stumbles upon the perfect Chris Pine Spider-Man. I love that it's Chris Pine, because some of this they had kept pretty well secret. Like, they cut out of all the trailers the Chris Pine Spider-Man, the Spider-Noir character I didn't know was in this, and Penny. There's even shots in the movie where Penny and Spider-Noir are in there, but if you go to the trailer, they've cut them out of the trailer very cleverly, which I thought was nice. So there were some nice surprises. So you have perfect Chris Pine Spider-Man, who's trying to shut down this reactor. I love that we just feel like we've stepped into, as you say, like this universe where there's a perfect Spider-Man and he's having his perfect Spider-Man adventure, but it goes awry here. And that whole sequence is so good. And I love that there is some emotional weight to the death of Peter Parker here, with Kingpin is fucking brutal in this movie. And there's the scene where Spider-Man gives Miles the drive and like entrusts him with this. All of that is so, so, so well done. We should probably also talk about Kingpin in this movie is great.
Yeah. I love they went with this like really exaggerated design for him that at first, because I think he was in a trailer or like a poster or something that I saw, I was like, I don't know if that, like, because everybody else looks like a human being and then Kingpin is this huge like block man, but then in the actual movie I think that design works really well, because it makes it him, he's like legitimately frightening because he's like strangely like inhuman in his appearance.
And Miles is small. Like, he's a short kid. There's the whole sequence where he's talking about, is this puberty? I don't know what puberty is. And you're like, right, he's still growing. He's probably got another growth spurt or two in him. He's going to have to get this Spider-Man costume hemmed or something. But he's very small. Kingpin is inhumanly large. And just that, I mean, it's not graphic, but it feels graphic of him just bringing down his arms on Spider-Man. I mean, ouch, that hurt.
Yeah, and it's, you know, like when any time in, like, whether it's some alternate universe bullshit, whatever, anytime Peter Parker dies, it hits me real hard. It's super, It's fucked up. It's a fucked up thing to do.
Because this movie doesn't reverse it either. Again, I thought what they were going to do is fling him into another dimension, and he'd be gone but not dead, and then at the end of the movie they might get him back. But they don't do that at all. He's just fucking dead.
Yeah, that's one dead Peter Parker, and then fucking Mary Jane has to
eulogize him,
deliver the eulogy, and it's like, oh my god, it's so brutal.
It's worth saying also just how perfectly cast this movie is, because we talk about Chris Pine is great for that Spider-Man. That's just a perfect voice for that. I didn't notice who did Mary Jane, but I thought, I'm like, that's a really good Mary Jane voice. And I can't, I'm looking up here, but like another one was the Kingpin is Liev Schreiber. That was a really good choice for Kingpin. Like Liev Schreiber can be kind of hit or miss for me, but I thought the voice was just on point. It was a very scary voice of that, you know?
Yeah.
Oh man, I can't find it here. That's too bad. I will keep looking that up. But yeah, all of these were good. Lily Tomlin as Aunt May was just, that was another just great piece of casting.
Yeah, it's a great Aunt May.
Yeah, it's a great Aunt May. There's a lot of these here, obviously, we can get into. Like, we haven't talked about Miles' family was. It was Mahershala Ali as Aaron Davis. That was perfect. And then you had Brian Tyree Henry as Jefferson Davis, who, amazing actor, amazing performance. He might be getting an Oscar nomination this year for If Beale Street Could Talk, which I'm excited to go see. So he's having a good year. Yeah, just so many good voices in this, before you even get into the larger Spider-Verse thing. But yes, then we do get all the other Spider-Man people, Sean. I mean, they're all, some of these characters are bigger than other ones. Do you want to just take some of the kind of sillier ones up top here?
Yeah. That I think that's a good way to do it. Let's talk about it. Cause I think there's the, cause it's, you have the sort of three really silly spider people. And then you have the three like serious ones, the three serious ones being Miles, older Peter and, Spider Gwen. But then the three silly ones, Spider Ham, Penny Parker, pilot of Spider SP/DR, the mech, and then Spider-Man Noir, played by fucking Nicolas Cage, which is such good casting.
And I had missed that completely. Had you? Like, I did not know he was in
this. I think I had heard Nicolas Cage was in the movie, but I don't know if I knew who he played.
God, that is the best use of Nicolas Cage, at least since Kick-Ass, probably longer than Kick-Ass. I would take this over Kick-Ass any day, so I don't even know how far you have to go back for a better use of Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, it's really good. So which one do you want to talk about first?
Sean? I mean, let's just do Peter Porker. Let's like go up the ladder a little bit. That's John Mulaney doing Peter Porker. Oh, it's so good.
Oh, that's good.
The other thing is they don't overuse him. Like, I could totally see a version of this where it gets Deadpool-esque and like they go too irreverent. And in that version, I think you could make, in this context, Spider-Ham annoying. He's not annoying. Like, he comes in for a joke. It's usually a very good joke. And then he kind of gets out. And even then, like, you get to the end of the movie and he's going back to his universe and it's kind of an emotional send-off because it's like, oh, I liked you, Spider-Ham. And it's just, he's very funny. I love how they, again, you could only do this in animation. You can literally, because he can kind of bend reality. All of that is great. I'm forgetting the moment I loved most was when he's leaving and he gives Miles the big mallet and he says, this will fit in your pocket, kid. And Miles is just like, okay, bye, man. It's so good.
Yeah, it's just I just love the use of him as being, he's the, like, the gag cartoon character, and I think maybe best Spider-Ham moment in the movie for me is when he fucking drops an anvil on Scorpion. It just took me so by surprise that it happens. I'm like, what the fuck? Is that an anvil? And it's like, oh, right, Spider-Ham is in this movie. Of course he dropped an anvil on Scorpion.
So good. And they've actually talked about possibly doing shorts with him because it would fit kind of the Looney Tunes model so well. And, oh my god, they should. It's so good.
God, I love before he leaves, he says, that's all, folks. And old Spider-Peter Parker is like, can he even say that, like, legally speaking?
It's great. All right, then you have Spider-Man Noir, Nicolas Cage. Oh, it's such a good performance. I love all the visual stuff around him. I love the hints we get of his backstory, because I like how all of the silly backstories just overlap and they're cutting against each other. And it's just got the exact right touch where they don't, like, push it too dark or too silly. It's just, he fits in this universe. Nick Cage, it's a great voice. It's a great visual design. I fucking love that costume. And
yeah,
latching on to the Rubik's Cube joke is so inspired. I love it.
Yeah, it's the thing of where no other movie could do this. It's only because the movie, I think, is so effective at grounding the emotional reality of the movie in the first, like, 15 to 30 minutes or so, that then once you get to this point, you can introduce Spider-Man Noir, voiced by Nicolas Cage. He's, like, you know, not trying to disguise the voice. It's very obviously Nicolas Cage. He's not doing something with his voice. Like, obviously, he's playing the character well, but it's... If you've ever seen Nicolas Cage in a movie, you can identify immediately, holy shit, that's Nicolas Cage playing Spider-Man Noir. And yeah, he has, like, it's full-on, like, jokes about, like, noir monologues and shit like that. His vocabulary is so weird and, like, heightened in that noir-esque way. And then you lean super hard into the he's from some weird black-and-white universe. And we're meant to understand, like, diegetically in the reality of the movie that the movie exists in, the world, the multiverse universe that Spider-Man Noir literally comes from is literally black and white. It's not just a gag. Like, he's looking at that fucking Rubik's Cube, and he's like, is it blue? No. Green? No. It's like, okay.
I love it. And at the end, he's like, I'm taking this with me because I need to figure this out. It's so good. And then you've got Penny Parker, who is such a revelation. We need a Penny Parker anime. This is the one spider person in this I had never heard of before, was Penny Parker. There's a comic about her, I assume.
Yeah, well, she comes from the original Spider-Verse crossover.
Okay.
And then I think they did a, like, spin-off comic, like, short run with her or something.
But she's great. I love how much they lean into the anime of it all. The whole idea of the spider controls the mech, it's so good. And then the end where, like, she loses the mech is, like... It was weirdly affecting. I'm really glad the spider lived and she's going back, and it's just, it's exciting.
Yeah, if there's one thing I wanted more from the movie, it is Penny. Like, she's the one of the three joke characters that, and this is probably just, like, my obvious bias of I like anime, I like mech stuff, so of course I want to see more of this version of the character. But there's so much to Penny Parker than there is to Spider-Man Noir and Spider-Ham. There's, like, clearly this, like, whole, like, you can kind of imagine the world of Spider-Ham, and, like, you could go read the Spider-Ham comics if you want to know more about his world, and then obviously the same thing with Spider-Man Noir, but Spider-Man Noir in his comics is not a joke. I feel like it was a good idea and smart of them to say, we're going to do a jokey version of the character, because a serious version of Spider-Man Noir would be probably too dark even for this movie, but there's something about Penny Parker that it feels like the world that she must come from must be so vibrant, because she's got, like, she's not even really a Spider-Man. Like, even Spider-Ham is more of a Spider-Man than Penny. She's this, like, weird Japanese schoolgirl from, like, New York in the 21st century with a robot pal that is controlled by a spider with whom she has a psychic link. That's a movie. That's its own movie. Like, I don't need to see a Spider-Ham movie or Spider-Man Noir movie. I need the Penny Parker movie because it's such a good idea.
I need 26 episodes of the Penny Parker anime TV series. That's what I want.
Yes. That's more to the point of what we really need. That doesn't seem super possible, but I need more of that character because she does feel more real. And the scene, the whole monologue, or not monologue, the montage scene where she is, like, remaking the gizmo or the goober or whatever while she's, like, eating potato chips and shit inside her mech. It's just so good, and it's so vibrantly realized.
It's so good. It really, like, oftentimes I find when Hollywood movies reference anime, you can tell they don't get it. This feels like there is a Penny Parker anime in the world, and they ripped her out of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's the difference between this and a lot of other movies that I think would do it in a lesser way. But she's great. And then, yeah, you have the Gwen Stacy of this movie, Spider-Woman, who is awesome and totally deserves her own movie because she's just a great character. And, oh my God, her costume is cool.
The Spider-Gwen costume is amazing. I mean, I feel like that is the thing that made that character, like, as soon as they, like, released the design for that character when they're doing Spider-Verse stuff, and I saw, oh, they're doing this, like, weird alternate reality Gwen Stacy, who's, like, became a Spider-Woman when she was, like, 16, and it has that awesome design. It's like, that's its own comic book, and she has had a Spider-Gwen comic that's been running for a couple of years now.
Awesome. That's so,
like,
cool.
It's so good. Because I haven't read much of the Spider-Gwen comic, but from what I understand, her backstory of, like, being in the band and Peter, like, there you see Peter turn into the Lizard, and, like, that's the whole backstory from her reality, is that her best friend, Peter Parker, like, wants to have powers and turns himself into the Lizard and then dies in the process. And I thought, like, that was cool that they, like, more directly incorporated her comic book stuff in that backstory than they did for the more gaggy Spider-Man characters.
Oh, absolutely. And I would love... I want the movie where it's Spider-Woman and she is in the band and it is a rock and roll movie with superheroes in it. And I want, like, the climax to be she's trying to get to the Battle of the Bands, but, you know, Vulture is over here doing some shit, or whoever the villain is, and she has to, like, save the day and then go, you know, shred on the guitar. I want that so bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. But she's great. I think the whole introductory sequence with her at the high school is really charming and nice, and you feel for poor Miles because, you know, it's not his fault. It's really not his fault. But you also feel for her because it's like, this is weird. This is a weird interaction with a boy.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole first act of the movie with that stuff is, I think, by far the best version of Spider-Man's powers as metaphor for puberty I've ever seen. Because it's not even really a metaphor at some point, almost. Like, they're so sort of lampshading it in front, literally. It's like, he thinks that maybe he actually has puberty. It's not just, like, you reading between the lines about it in, like, the beginning of the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movie. And, yeah, that whole scene is, it's, like, brutal in that, like, you know, embarrassing comedy kind of way between him and Gwen. But I thought it was a good, I love that that's how she gets this, like, rad punk hairstyle, is that she has to cut her hair because his hand is stuck to it. And so for the rest of the movie, she just looks like a fucking punk badass, and it's awesome.
It's a good haircut. You know, he's not lying. I like that haircut. She's great. That's a Hailee Steinfeld doing the voice, we should say, who was the awesome little girl in True Grit. And yeah. I love that she's still around doing things. And she's really good in this. So that was great.
Yeah, and it's very smart of them to say that they're working on a spinoff that's going to be Spider-Women with that. Presumably she's going to be the main one of them.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. Oh, she definitely shines out in this movie.
Yeah, she could easily carry a film. It's awesome. And then you have shitty Spider-Man is kind of what I was thinking of him as. Because he is not a shitty person. He's just in a point of his life where he is just in a shitty point of his life, right?
I mean, it's washed up Spider-Man.
Yeah, it's washed up Spider-Man. It's Jake Johnston from New Girl, who is... It's a great, great, great performance by him. It's also like, if you think about the animated thing, like, Jake Johnston, and I'm not insulting him, but he could never play Spider-Man, right? There's no world where Jake Johnston, who is... He's not, like, schlubby, he's not, like, fat or anything, but he's not, you know... He's not the toned guy you go to play a superhero, and he's also on the older side for that kind of role. But he can do the voice, which is awesome. And his voice is so perfect for this. And I think, you know, obviously it's in some ways a cliched arc of, like, the washed-up hero who mentors the kid, that sort of thing. One thing I love is that they do away with the he doesn't want to mentor the kid pretty early in the movie. Like, they get past that pretty early on. And then I think it's just, yeah, it's an old song, but it's played so, so well here of him kind of finding himself again by mentoring this younger guy. It's done very, very well. When you get to the end and he's like, you know, I am scared of going back and having to face reality. It's, again, we've seen that moment before. We haven't seen it with this kind of animation and in a Spider-Man context and done just that perfectly. I loved it.
Yeah, and I think one thing that makes it, while it is a cliche, it doesn't feel, and it never really felt like a cliche to me, was the Spider-Man side of it. That having, because it's Peter Parker, because it's this alternate reality version of Peter Parker, that honestly just feels like normal Peter Parker when he gets into his 30s. Yeah. Like, it's, you know, hard for me to imagine a, like, properly, fully, like, adult, like, approaching middle-aged Spider-Man that whose life has not totally fallen apart. You know, like, if he's still kind of trying to be Spider-Man, his life is going to be full of tragedy and it's going to be shit and he's never going to get his life together, because you can never get your life together when you're trying to have a life and also be Spider-Man at the same time and have nobody know about it. Like, there's just no feasible way for that to ever work. And so there's just something about seeing that version of Peter that also has this, like, real emotional reality that is founded not just in what they're presenting in the character, but in the, like, the character that exists outside this movie and that they're riffing on and that they're so aware of, and him being this sort of, like, you know, darker reflection of the very perfect version of Peter that you see that exists in this reality. And you see this, like, well, this is what happens and it doesn't go quite as well, and it's like 10 years later and, you know, his hair is starting to gray a little bit and he's got this scruff and he's maybe doesn't have quite the chiseled spider body he used to have. And that side of the movie, I really sort of latched onto this weird, washed up older Peter Parker a lot, because he spoke to things that I always really like in the character, and the idea of there being a washed up Peter Parker that has to work his way back to being Spider-Man. It's a cliche kind of character arc, but when you have Spider-Man doing it, it has a deeper resonance for me.
I agree, and it's just so well done. I think it complements Miles' arc so beautifully. This is not a case where, like with Spider-Gwen, where I feel like I need the movie about the Jake Johnson Spider-Man. I think they did everything they needed to do with his character right here, and the point of the character is not to set up a spinoff or anything. And they really, it's a really special part of this movie. And, you know, it's another thing where when I saw the trailers, I'm like, okay, who is this character going to be in full? Because I wasn't sure. And the full range of this character is more than I was expecting. Like, there's the moment where he sees Aunt May, and mm-hmm. his Aunt May is dead, which they linger on in his backstory. And it's just beautiful. It's a beautiful moment. It made me think of, like, maybe this is like the Spider-Man of the video game 10 years later, you know?
Yeah.
And because I could totally see that Spider-Man, who is a very encumbered, burdened Spider-Man, you know, and Aunt May dies in the game, spoiler, coming and having that moment. And it's just, it's like, oh my God. Like I think what's brilliant about the Jake Johnson Spider-Man is that it's a specific version of the character, but it's also broad enough that you can kind of read into it any Spider-Man you like, you know? It could be the Tobey Maguire character. It could be the Insomniac Spider-Man. It could be the guy from Spectacular Spider-Man, that awesome TV series we love. That feels actually a lot like a clear precedent to this one in terms of how it uses animation. But, and now I want to go watch the whole thing again. But anyway, it's so good.
Yeah, and I think it's just one of the smart things about, it's not, he's not just fuck up Spider-Man. He is Spider-Man 10 years later.
Yeah.
Like past the, because he's outside the point where you ever see Spider-Man naturally represented in any media. Like he is in his mid-20s at his oldest. That's the oldest you almost ever see Spider-Man outside of alternate reality bullshit. Like here's like the future Spider-Man that is the dad to Spider-Girl or whatever in that comic line. Like you have a couple of instances like that, but you never see Peter in his mid-30s. And so this version of him that, like, yeah, there are those handful of moments, like when he sees Aunt May, and then also when he sees this universe as Mary Jane, and that whole like extended bread joke in Misunderstanding, I think is very good. And it just, it feels very real. And it feels like, as you said, it builds on your knowledge and love for any version of Peter Parker you've seen. It builds from that.
Yeah. So Sean, let's talk about the climax of the film, which is visually, like, the movie had already been pretty fucking cool. And then it's like, hey, what if we just let the fucking multiverse explode inside this room and did whatever the hell we want for the next 20 minutes? And I wanted to, like, stand up and cheer. It looked and sounded and played so fucking cool and like nothing else. And when I say, like, the first thing I said about this on the podcast today is, like, this movie makes me disappointed in the last 20 years of movies. This is the kind of thing I'm talking about, where it's like, let's compare this to, like, Doctor Strange, which has a lot of surreal LSD kind of imagery, too. I really liked Doctor Strange, the movie. It's a solid little film. Doctor Strange, the animated movie made like this, is something I want now, you know? Because it's like, okay, what if you didn't have to fucking worry about... Because Doctor Strange, the Scott Derrickson movie, obviously is mostly CGI for those trippy sequences, but it has to look like the real locations, and it has to have real Benedict Cumberbatch in it. What if you didn't have to do that? What if he was just animated and you just went fucking crazy with it and it wasn't like a thing that breaks into the aesthetics of the movie? What if it was just the aesthetic? And it's like, that's such a cool idea to me. And it's part of what I think holds back superhero movies in some ways is this reluctance to ever go beyond live action, which is such a crazy thing. Because again, the space aliens would come to Earth and be like, Wait, these are based on comic books? They're based on animated things? Why don't you make animated comic book movies? That's what they would ask, right? And it's like, we don't know. We don't know why we don't do it. Big Hero 6, which is the Disney movie from a couple years ago, not nearly as good as this Spider-Man film, but it's also a Marvel superhero movie made in animation. And it's also got some sequences in it that just made me feel like, I want more of this. I want more animated superheroics. And it's just the sheer scale of imagination in Into the Spider-Verse and the skill with which it is pulled off in scenes like this makes me want it out of other movies. And other movies will not always have the same level of imagination and skill, but I want to see other people swing for the fences like this.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that it, you know, it pulls so much inspiration from like the like more modern comic books that have way more experimental visual styles and will just go fucking crazy with how they'll use panels and use space and like draw geometry and draw characters. And it's one of the things that's great about modern comics is how stylistically adventurous they can be. And that's so translated in this movie. And yeah, longtime listeners of this podcast will know that we're both fans of like just doing weird, crazy shit when you get, when you do effects. And it is the thing, it's one of the reasons why we like Thor 2 more than most people like Thor 2 is because, yeah, the villain sucks in that movie, but the climax of Thor 2 where they're like going through all these portals and it's like, what if we made it like a fucking, what if we made a like $100 million portal fan film action scene? Like that's what the ending of fucking Thor 2 is. And that's awesome. And it's doing something that like, you know, even though I love, you know, the Captain America movies, and the Captain America movies have basically the best action scenes in the Marvel movies. At the end of the day, it's like two really strong dudes punching each other, and it's really well choreographed and well made. But sometimes it's like, well, but we also can just have Doctor Strange craziness happening, and we can also have portals, or the zenith of it now, the peak, the like benchmark from which all things now will have to be compared to is the climax of Spider-Verse, where you already have like the most visually arresting, creative, incredible looking fucking superhero movie ever made. And then now you're having all of that stuff and the universes are colliding. And so there's just this insane, like spinning kaleidoscope of skyscrapers and buses and trains and city streets spinning around while six different spider people are fighting like three Spider-Man villains, Tombstone, Scorpion, and Kingpin, and it's just going fucking nuts, and they're all trying to, like, press this button, but none of them can do it, and there's an army of guys, like, standing on the rafters, just shooting laser beams at everybody. It's just absurd. It's the imagination and the creativity of it, and it's the thing that when you're utterly unhinged from having to constantly represent a certain level of reality because you have actual people filmed on screen, once you can let go of any of that shit and it's everything is just what you can imagine, and as long as you can imagine it, you can create it, it allows the form of incredible expressionism that you have in this movie to totally shine through and take over everything else, and allows, you know, the final like action scene, the climactic scene between Spider-Man, Miles, and Kingpin at the end of the movie is in this like totally weird abstract space on the top of some train floating in like, you know, Technicolor barf in the back of the screen, and it's just madness and insanity, and it's so fucking beautiful and incredible. And it's as you say, it's the kind of thing that I really desperately want, particularly Western media, because this is one of the reasons why I go to anime, is that anime will do crazy shit like this. Like, go watch the end of Dragon Ball Super. It's not exactly as, you know, the same kind of insanity, but is doing insane shit that you would never dream of being able to do in a live action medium. Like, this is the reason why I'm such a huge fan of animation, and it's something that a lot of Western animated CG films just don't ever even try to do, and this movie fucking knocks it out of the park. It's unbelievable.
And it feels so right for Spider-Man to be the character that leads the way on this, because of every comic book character, I feel like Spider-Man is the one that makes the least sense in live action to me.
Yeah.
You know? And we love some of the Spider-Man live action movies. Spider-Man 2 is still the gold standard, as we've said many times. But the Spider-Man action, like the web swinging and all his powers, the actualization of Spider-Man's powers is never the best part of the Spider-Man live-action movies. And it never can be. Because fundamentally, Spider-Man's powers are too heightened to do in that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I remember when I watched the Spectacular Spider-Man TV series. This is the one that ran 26 episodes in the early two... In, like, 2010, was it?
Yeah, it was around there. Yeah, it was like... Yeah, because we would have been sophomores in high school. That sounds right.
Yeah, yeah. And we've talked about it. We should frankly do a rewatch of that and talk about it on the show someday, Sean, because it is so good.
Yeah.
But like, I remember watching that, and then forever I've always compared things to that, because I'm like, that so opened my eyes to like, oh right, this is an animated character. Comic books are a form of animation. They are drawing. They are pure imagination. And you are so limited when you bring that into reality. And Spider-Man just, like, fundamentally makes less sense than a lot of other characters. Like, there are some comic book characters that totally fine in live action. Like, Captain America, I'm not sure what you would benefit going to animation over live action. Batman totally works in live action. All these things, right?
Yeah.
But Spider-Man, after seeing Into the Spider-Verse, it's like, I feel so bad for Spider-Man Far From Home next year, because I'm sure it's going to have fun character moments, and it's going to be a funny movie, and it might have some good character stuff. I'm going to watch the action scenes and be like, that's fine, but I've got my Blu-ray of Into the Spider-Verse at home that I could go watch, you know? It just makes live-action stuff seem so anemic, and now I'm thinking, like, Thor, Doctor Strange. I'm sure there are plenty of other series I could think
of. Guardians of the Galaxy,
and Guardians of the Galaxy is animated enough that it evades this problem, but there's stuff like, if you just took your base assumption, like, if you looked at Thor on the page and said, what would this work best as, animation or live action, no one in their right mind would choose live action. And that's not to say the Thor movies are bad. They're not. Thor Ragnarok is good in part because it embraces that candy-colored pop aesthetic, you know? But, like, you would never, as a baseline, choose Thor to be a live-action thing unless you were just in a paradigm where all movies have to be live-action, you know?
You know, another good one for this is the Fantastic Four.
Oh, yeah. God,
the Fantastic Four. Like, if this team tackled a fucking Fantastic Four movie, holy shit. Like, going into the fucking, like, negative dimension and particularly Mr. Fantastic's powers would be... Are like never look good in live action.
No, you can't. I don't think you can do Mr. Fantastic in live action. It's just impossible. I think like The Thing presents a real problem where I think in CGI he looks bad next to everyone else. But if you put him in a suit like they did in the 2005 movie or whatever it is, I like that suit a lot, but there's not a lot they can do with it, you know? And so The Thing just is kind of a character who stands there, but he can't really fight. Yeah, the Fantastic Four. Like, I think now that Marvel is going to get all the Fox properties back, they should genuinely start an animation division. Yeah. Like, and do something like this and say, like, Fantastic Four, let's have it be an animated movie. X-Men, do an animated X-Men. We know that works. You know? And it would be different. It would be different than what we've had so far. Like, I have never walked out of a movie so hoping it grosses $1 billion as I did from Into the Spider-Verse, because I need this movie to be a game changer. Mm-hmm. I need this to be a movie that makes people question their assumptions about how they make this kind of film, because it so feels like it should be a game changer, you know?
Yes, 100%. If this movie doesn't sell well and it doesn't, like... Because it's obviously, like... People are going to love this movie. People already love this movie. It's going to at least be a cult classic if it doesn't ever become a true classic in the, like, broader cultural sense. But, yeah, it just... I so desperately hope it has the kind of wide-reaching cultural influence that it deserves to have and that we need, you know? Because it is... Again, it was like seeing that How to Train Your Dragon 3 trailer. Like, again, I'm sure those movies
And that's
are really
the
good.
Best of the best. That is the best of American animation.
But it's just, it's so hard for me to get that interested in it, because it's just like, especially when, like, now coming out of fucking Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, like, the fucking credits of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse look better than any 3D CG movie, any other 3D CG movie I've ever seen. Like, it's absurd. Like, how...
Well, it's...
How far in above and beyond Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is. It's not just, like, a little bit more creative and a little bit more adventurous. It is like it came from another dimension.
And it is, like, it's this weird movie where, like, you started this conversation by saying it kind of operates in three dimensions as a Spider-Man fan, as just a fan of movies, a fan of animation. For me, it's like it straddles this line between it feels like a radical reinvention for superhero movies and a radical reinvention for animated movies, and both of those need to happen, you know? Yeah. Like, both of those need to be thought about. And honestly, I might even find the animated side of it more interesting, because animated movies have been so homogeneous, I mean, throughout the history, basically, of American animation. Like, this is just a persistent problem, is that Disney has kind of steamrolled everything since the 1920s, for fuck's sake. But now it's like, it really does feel like since the Pixar revolution of the late 90s, just that's what movies look like. And that's and since Shrek came out in 2001, that's what non-Disney movies play like. They do the pop culture thing, and they do all this shit. And this is a movie that it breaks every paradigm for animation that is out there. It breaks a lot of the paradigms for superhero movies, but it doesn't reinvent that wheel as thoroughly as it does the animation wheel. And I think, if nothing else, I hope this makes other animators, I'm sure, want to do other kinds of things. I hope it makes other studios tell animators, well, that worked. Do whatever you want. Clearly, you can do more than this, right?
Yeah.
And that's so cool to me. And also, it only cost $90 million. Like, clearly the paradigm is costly and shitty. Like, what the fuck are you doing if it takes $300 million to make Tangled, which would have been better as a hand-drawn Disney movie? Clearly, if you watch that, the Tangled is fine. It has no, it does not need to be CGI. It would have been much better as cell animation. This is just so cool. It feels like seeing a whole new world of possibilities opened.
Which is very appropriate for the movie that's about the fucking multiverse cracking open and just, yeah, and all hell breaking loose.
I also want to say, this makes me even sadder about the Fox buying Disney or Disney buying Fox thing, because this is not a Fox movie, this is a Sony movie. But for the last few years, you know, you've got Disney has been dominating the superhero space because they have Marvel.
And WB is fucking up constantly.
Yeah, WB is just doing their fucking weird jerk-off thing over there, minus Wonder Woman, which was good. And then you have the other competitors are Sony with their Spider-Man stuff and Fox with their X-Men stuff. Now, Fox and Sony have really spotty track records with those properties, no doubt about it. But over the last couple years, I would say the three best superhero movies that have been made are Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Logan, and Black Panther. One of those is a Disney movie. Two of those are not. And Logan and Into the Spider-Verse would not exist if Disney had these properties. They just wouldn't. Disney would never make Logan. They would never make it. They would make Logan before they would make Into the Spider-Verse, right?
I agree, yes. Because if they were going to make an animated Spider-Man movie, it would be in the Disney style.
Yes, it would be in the Disney style. They would never, ever make this. And I would trade in about half of the MCU, maybe all of the MCU, for the existence of Into the Spider-Verse. And that's not to say that I like the MCU a whole lot, but this is better than, I think, anything they've ever made. Yeah, it is so good, and it wouldn't exist if there wasn't the competition that forced Sony to say, we need to do something new and crazy. Now, that new and crazy also resulted in Venom, and Venom is crap, obviously, but, like, fuck it, if that experimentation gave us both Venom and Into the Spider-Verse, then the experimentation worked, because one of those worked beautifully. Like, that's what experimentation is for. Maybe it doesn't always work, but one crazy idea went nowhere, one crazy idea brought us this. That's why you have competition, and, you know, like, Deadpool is actually another example of something that would never have been made if that competition didn't exist. And Deadpool is not on the same level as these things, but I like Deadpool being a movie in the world. And the more Disney eats up this space, the less we're going to get films like this. And I hope this kind of refuels a sense of, like, there are more things we can do. If Marvel has perfected their game over here, then let's stop trying to play Marvel's game and let's do something new. That is the lesson of Into the Spider-Verse to me. That's the lesson of Logan to me, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It is that, like, because this movie, I don't know what it was like at your movie theater, Jonathan, but it's like the most crowd-pleasing movie I've seen in forever. Like, my entire theater was so into it, laughing at every fucking joke. Like, it was such a positive energy in the movie theater, I felt, in a way that, like, I think part of it kind of took me by surprise, just to this is, it's been so long since I saw an animated movie, and I have no idea what the last 3D CG movie, so it's like, obviously the audience skewed more towards families and with children. But still, it was just a sense of, like, every single joke is landing. Every single emotional beat is landing. This audience is completely invested. Like, I'm completely invested. People were so jazzed coming out of the movie theater. And you had, like, it was the opposite of what... Or it felt like back in fucking 2008 with Iron Man, where you had the post-credit scene of Iron Man with the Avengers, like... tease with Nick Fury, and it was that sense of, like, all the people coming out of the theater, you had the comic book nerd in each group who's like, oh yeah, fucking Samuel Jackson's playing Nick Fury because it was like the Ultimate Comics kind of did that, and then so the Avengers are this big team of all these other superheroes. It was like the comic book nerd in the group feeling, like, vitalized and, like, legitimized by the movie, because Iron Man felt like a movie that came from a comic book, like, background from people who liked comic books, and the comic book nerd was, like, the king of that group, and it was, like, this moment was, like, it's cool to be a nerd. Now we're in this space where you come out of the end of a Marvel movie, and even if the Marvel movie's really good, the comic book nerd in the group is exhausted. because we're fucking tired. Like, I can't explain Thanos to people anymore. I don't want to explain who the fucking Collector is or who, like, the Watchers are from the, like, I think that was Guardians 2 had that it wasn't the post-credit scene, but had the cameo with Stan Lee and the Watchers. Like, it's exhausting to try to explain all that stuff to people. And now, like, Spider-Man into the Spider-Verse makes it feel cool again. It makes it feel like exciting again to be a person that has access to this information because it is so in love with the comic books and with this character and with the world that this comes from. And it feels so energized and so fresh that everybody coming out of the movie is just like, holy fucking shit, this was amazing.
Yeah, it was a small audience at my screening in a very, very big auditorium, so it was kind of spread out. So I didn't have a great sense during the movie. There was a group of clear, like, big comic book nerds right behind me, and they were very into it. But when the movie got out, and you're all going out through the same hallway, so you hear everyone's thoughts, it's the most unanimous love for a movie I've heard in forever. Yeah. Black Panther would be up there, I think. It was just pure positivity. I don't know if you've seen, like, in addition to all the critical praise, there's the group that does surveys of films to see, like, what audiences thought, CinemaScore. This got an A+.
Holy
which,
shit.
That never happens. Like you usually get an... Like, it's a pretty small range. It goes from, like, B to A is what most people give movies, because people aren't generally that mean when they come out of movies, unless they're like you or I, and give it an F. But an A+ is that's high, especially in an age where I feel like just, not just politically, but just, like, culturally, we like to be divided, you know? Mm-hmm. This movie, like, people fucking love it. And, you know, I hope it looks like it's going to have a pretty small opening weekend, around 40 million, but animated movies tend to open small and, like, linger. And it won't have any competition in the near future, I don't think. Mary Poppins could, like, fuck with its mojo, because it's not animated, but it's a family thing. But it's got a good month before movies start coming back into theaters in big numbers for it to, like, grow by word of mouth. And if nothing else, this movie's going to have insane word of mouth.
Yeah, like, I don't know if my brother has seen it or not, because he lives in New York, but I'm going to ask him when he comes in, obviously for, like, the Christmas holidays, if he's seen it or not, and if he hasn't, I'm 100% going to see this movie again with him, because he's going to love this fucking movie, and he has no particular attachment to Spider-Man, but it's like, if you just enjoy animated films, like, regardless of, like, even you could fucking probably hate Spider-Man, and as long as you really like animated films, you could watch this movie and you'd be like, this is like, I don't know if it would change your opinion on Spider-Man. I can't imagine the mind of someone who hates Spider-Man, but it's harder for me to imagine someone disliking this movie than it is for me of someone just hating Spider-Man in general. Like, even if you hate Spider-Man, this movie's so good. It's such a crowd pleaser. It's just so outrageously funny, which is something we didn't talk that much about, but it's just every single joke I thought landed. Some of the humor, all the humor is very character-based, and there's just some of those sequences, like when Miles and Peter are infiltrating that base and when Doc Ock is revealed and Peter's, like, getting fucking hurled around the room by Doc Ock and he's slamming into the window. It's like, everything's fine! All of those jokes, they're not necessarily all, like, 100% original jokes, but they are done with such aplomb and such vitality to them, and it's so... Every beat of this movie is so well executed that I was cackling the whole way through.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah, absolutely. The Stan Lee cameo and dedication, we should mention.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, good God. For this to be the first Stan Lee cameo after he passed is such a beautiful, weird happenstance. Because they couldn't have known. They were working on this for years. But it is one of the best Stan Lee cameos, one of the most meaningful. And then the dedication, which they obviously added at the last minute. I love that it was to both him and Steve Ditko. And I think how it tied into the message, it just, the verisimilitude of it is so perfect. You know?
It goes back to what I was saying about this feeling like truly proper postmodern art, is that, like, that sense of boundary between the movie and reality is so porous that, you know, even if Stan Lee hadn't died, it would have, like, so much resonance, because he has, you know, his cameo is that scene where he's giving Miles that Spider-Man costume that he's going to go wear to Peter's funeral, and, like, or not like he's necessarily his funeral, but, like, the elegy basically for Spider-Man that Mary Jane is holding. It's great on two levels, in that the joke is very funny and it's very knowing of, you know, that Stan Lee, you know, that we had the whole you know, the Rest in Peace Stan Lee section of the podcast a couple of weeks ago after he passed away, and that, you know, you cannot talk about Stan Lee without talking about, like, he was a fucking businessman, he was a showman, so his whole thing of, like, he gives no refunds for the costume works as, like, a really good Stan Lee joke that I'm sure he found fucking hilarious. But then also there is so much heart, and it's so central to the message of the movie, of him saying that, you know, everybody will grow into the costume eventually. Like, it, you know, then that everybody can wear this costume, which is what the movie is about. And then giving that to Stan Lee has so much power. And then the dedication, and they have that quote at the end that he gave about, like, what heroism is and that everybody can be a superhero. Man. It's so powerful, and it's just so resonant throughout the whole film. And it's that aspect of the movie where I really think, like, the more and more I'm thinking about this movie and talking about it with you, the more and more I feel like it's not just a great crowd-pleasing family film, but it is, there's so much more going on deeper to be explored with this movie.
Oh.
What it's saying about heroes and pop culture and, like, our relationship towards, like, the superhero medium.
This is a great film. This needs no apology or qualification. It is a great movie. Like, if I'm not sure if I'm doing my top 10 films list this year. I probably will. There's been a lot of good movies this year, and I have not a ton to catch up on. And luckily, a lot of the big movies at the end of the year are coming out on Netflix. So thank you, Netflix. That makes it very easy to catch up on films. This will be on my top 10. It'll be high on my top 10. Like, this is one of the best films of the year. Like, again, if this does not win that animated feature Oscar, like, this feels like the most obvious shoe-in for an Oscar ever. In any category, like, if you look at this movie and you don't think, yes, that was the best animated film of this year, you're fucking high. Mm-hmm. Like, you're out of it if you don't think that this is that, and Oscar voters tend to be out of it because they're 80 years old and high on, I don't know, painkillers or something. But, like, yeah, that's so clear to me. This is a just a great work of cinematic, you know, pop art. I love it. It's so good. And, you know, we always have this conversation when we talk about a great comic book movie. We always hold them up to Spider-Man 2.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the case where it's like, okay, this is the best Spider-Man movies in Spider-Man 2 easily, right?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. It's might be the best comic book movie since Spider-Man 2. I'd have to think about it.
It is.
But it probably is, yeah. And now you hold it up next to Spider-Man 2. And this is an impossible question to answer because we've had Spider-Man 2 in our lives for 14 years. And why we love it so much is in part because it's endured for 14 years. So I'm not going to make us answer, is this better or worse than Spider-Man 2? But I will say, it feels like it belongs on the same level as it.
I will say, because I, again, like as you just laid out very good reasons for why it is impossible to answer the question, which is better. But I can say definitively, the two best superhero movies are this movie and Spider-Man 2 for me.
Yeah.
Like, for me, there's no real competition. It makes it easy because I'm not as huge a fan as The Dark Knight as a lot of people are, because I feel like The Dark Knight is the other one that is way up there for most people. And since I'm not insanely, like, I think Dark Knight is a great movie. Maybe we'll talk more about it and depending on how people vote. But this movie is so incredible and digs into everything that I love and want superhero movies to do. And it is such, this feels like such a pioneering step that it is easily one of the two best superhero movies ever made that I have seen.
And I've seen basically all of them. And I think that's totally fair. You just feel like you're watching something really goddamn special while you're watching this. And it's so cool.
Yeah.
I'm so glad this movie exists. It feels like a dream that this movie is this good.
Yeah, because it definitely felt like there was, like, when we were seeing the trailers and stuff, and you know, we were so blown away by that first trailer. I think we had a pretty long talk about it on the podcast when that happened. But it always seemed like there were one of two tracks that the movie could go down. It would either be, like, fucking great, brilliant masterpiece, which is where it is, or it would be like, oh man, the aesthetic is so good, but the rest of the movie is like, I think it was kind of what you're saying, that's like, it might be too bloated, maybe they might not focus enough on Miles, and there's too much crazy Spider-Man zaniness going on, that while it is like a feast for the eyes and it's this incredible aesthetic achievement, the actual storytelling doesn't hold up to that bar. And I'm very glad that we existed in the universe where, no, like, it clears the storytelling bar and then some. It is like the whole package is incredible as a whole, and it's not just that aesthetic, it's everything about the movie that is incredible.
I think it is amazing we live in a world where we finally got, you know, live-action Peter Parker Spider-Man back in the MCU. We got Tom Holland as this awesome version of the character. We got his own standalone movie. And that is by far the least interesting thing to happen to Spider-Man in other media in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
Like, Spider-Man Homecoming, it's good. Spider-Man the video game and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse are fucking amazing.
Yeah, it feels like this true Spider-Man renaissance we're living through, which is fucking awesome for me.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, it's so cool. Yeah, I mean, because yeah, Spider-Man, this movie would be on my top 10 movies, and Spider-Man the video game will easily be on my top 10 video games list.
Yep.
I'm not sure exactly where for either one, but they are comfortably within there. They will not get kicked out. And that's crazy. That's so cool.
I mean, God, like, obviously this does not mean nearly as much for me as it does for you, since I see very few movies in the movie theater. But I was trying to think about it. This is probably the best movie I've seen in the movie theater since Mad Max. Like, it's been all... It's, again...
For the movies you've seen, I actually think that's completely fair.
Yeah, like, I don't see that many movies in the movie theater these days. But it's fucking... It's fucking really good.
It's really good. I can't wait to see it again. Because, you know, in Iowa City here, we have a nice... Our theater is totally nice. It's good. It's competent. In Colorado, we have some theaters I really, really love. And there's a theater called the Cine Capri we have up north that is the biggest screen in Colorado. It's like 70 feet wide. It's amazing. And I cannot wait to go see that movie there because it is my favorite theater in the world. And I just can't wait to see it again. I'm going to bring my brother, who hasn't seen it yet. And I just told him, like, just wait a couple days so I can see it with you again. Because I want to see it with someone who hasn't seen it and get to, like, talk to them about it. And, oh, man, I'm excited.
Yeah, this was also the best theater-going experience I've had in a long time. Like, because I did not go out of my way to go to a special theater to see it. But it was just, like, the projection was really good. It was a very smooth process getting in there. The audience was awesome. Like, I was very pleased. I felt like... Most theater-going experiences I have are marred by, like, several different things that get fucked up along the way. And this is just, no, this is great. It was awesome. They did a good job.
I got a free hot dog at my theater.
Nice.
Because I showed up and I paid for my ticket and they said, oh, you now have $5 on your rewards account. Because, you know, theaters have... I only have one theater chain here, so why not use the rewards card?
Makes sense.
You know? Yeah. And I got $5. I'm like, I'm kind of hungry. What's $5? A hot dog is $5. And I got a hot dog, and I don't know what it is about movie theater and ballpark hot dogs, but they're always better than anywhere else. And it was a good hot dog. And then the movie was really good. So it was just a good night.
Yeah, this is a good, like, this is such a New York movie that the hot dog is very appropriate food.
Oh, I was like, I was eating it, you know, I got it in my hand while he's running through the streets of New York. I'm like, yeah, this works.
Yeah.
This works.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's going to be it for this week. We will hit you back next week for our special fun Christmas celebration episode.
I'm excited to find out what that is because, again, I have no fucking idea.
It's good. It's going to be a blast. That's all I'll say. Okay, go ahead and check on my Twitter. Hopefully I have remembered to put up the poll about the movies, and you guys can go tell us which movie series you want us to do, and we will take that into account, and we will see where we go from there. Sean, any last words?
You know, depending on how that list goes, I should probably start looking at some Zatoichi movies and coming up with some ideas. That's all I'm going to say.